Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's July 12th, 2020, and welcome to episode 217 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RTR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and architecture switches, I guess. Architecture. I am Paul Hegstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts. From Toronto, we have Carrington Vanston. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Excellent.
Up with Carrington. Vote Carrington.
Big old card checked. And from Northern Virginia, we have Blake Patterson. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Glad to be here. Doing well. Nice cool day outside today, oddly, which was a nice treat. Breezy, a little cloudy. It felt pretty good.
Excellent. That's cool.
So instead of being outside in the nice weather, you're going to get in a stifling hot room full of retro computers.
Okay. So today, our host's topic is... It's basically kind of inspired by Apple's recent announcement that they're going to start moving their hardware to their own silicon. They're going to start moving to what is essentially an ARM-based platform. And this is something that has happened a couple times in the past in our sort of retro platforms. And many times it's been with Apple. At least those are the ones that I feel kind of like... that come to mind first, but it hasn't only been Apple. So we'll talk a little bit about just kind of that topic of managing the change in architectures, that kind of thing. What kind of switches have happened? So since Blake, you have been very eager to put things into the show notes, maybe I'll sort of start with you. Just you can maybe go through a couple of the things that you were thinking of. I don't know how to do this in any sensible way so that Blake doesn't just say all of them and then leaves us with nothing else to say.
Right,
that was not our style.
I don't want to run through.
Do it.
I'm not really sure how we can
talk about each one as they come up. Maybe
sure.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't we? Yeah, we can just go around. I guess the first item on the list, and you know what we're talking about here, as you just mentioned, what gave us the notion is the recent announcement by Apple that they're switching to ARM within the next 2 years. Which, I felt it was going to happen. I'm a little surprised that they indicated they were going to do it across the board and be complete within 2 years. I expected it to be a much more of a slow, phased situation. But, obviously they've got deep roadmaps and, they clearly have ideas of what they're going to put into silicon. So I guess we'll see, how much sense that ends up making in the end. I think it'll just, as I mentioned on Twitter earlier, and I think Carrington agreed, it'll make things a little more interesting it's not... PC, Mac has for, since 2006 been lockstep as far as, same available hardware. So it'll make it more of a show, which I kind of like.
It'll also make it more difficult to run Windows on Macs, which I do at work in a few instances for accounting. So that will be interesting.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things, I guess, I'll give my take on kind of what happened in the past and what's going on now. Well, most people listening are aware that, long ago, I don't know the precise year, it was in the early 90s, Apple switched from, they were, Motorola 68000 and derivative-based architecture to PowerPC, which for a short period had them giving, with a pretty significant performance lead over some of the Intel machines. That was when, RISC was the big... a hot topic, this new type of CPU, or at least it kind of it wasn't really new, but it was coming into the mainstream, for the first time. So
that's a thing we should mention, though. Apple really touted that about how like RISC is so much faster, and they had the bunnies and just like, oh my gosh, we're just trouncing everything. And I at the time was seriously into the Mac Kool-Aid, and I was big Mac fan. So I also would talk about how RISC is so much superior to CISC things, and you know, those short same size words, we can multi-thread everything, and look how fast this is. And yet in my heart I always knew, boy, my Mac seemed to be a lot slower than other people's computers. Given that I've got all these stats arguments, I do seem to be running a very slow computer. So there's the speed of the ISA, the architecture, and then there's the real world speed, and they never seemed to quite correspond to give me that blazing speed I was hoping for, alas.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think, when Apple rolled out, I mentioned that this was in the early 90s. Apple made the switch famously. I don't think anyone had ever done something like that, at least to that scale, as we talk about.
That's actually a really good point. Like previously, I think if you switch architectures, you just switched everything. Like Apple went from the Apple II to say the Macintosh or Apple III or whatever. And it was never this idea that you'll just like keep running your stuff. You chucked out the old one and said, here's the new computer. The idea that you say, oh no, it's going to just still be the Mac, say, and we'll have some other examples of that. And just, you're just going to keep going.
Yeah.
That's a weird thing to like change engines mid-drive.
Right.
Remarkable that can be done.
Yeah, it certainly. And some of the other examples, we'll see different ways that other companies have done it, whereas they generally weren't so much, we're going to take everything as it is and shift it to this architecture, and the goal is for it to be seamless. People have taken kind of different approaches that we'll get into that. But I will say that Apple did this in the early 90s, but RISC had been around. One of the earliest efforts for RISC is the Berkeley RISC project, which began at the UC Berkeley in 1980. And actually the first ISA instruction architecture was published in that effort in 1981, and so it's not, the notion of reduced instruction set computing, where the processor has a smaller number of rather basic commands and operations that it can perform, as opposed to a larger number of more complex and more, specific. Generally, RISC processors, have a far greater number of internal registers, and typically, as time, saw RISC processors emerge, they ended up with, because of the die space saved by, this more basic instruction set, they were able to have larger caches, which also helped, with performance. But anyway, so yes, Apple did this thing, and it's not like it was, RISC wasn't some brand new thing, but it was around that time that you started hearing in non-computer magazines. I remember about, like, there was the Digital Alpha, I think I remember there was a Popular Science on the cover, in early 90s, was a picture of the PowerPC and a picture of the DEC Alpha and a picture of HP's PA RISC. And it was an article that was telling, sort of more of a common group of people, not, techie nerds, what RISC was, because it was kind of coming to a head in the public as far as, what was available versus, Intel and the Motorola 68K, which were CISC, the complex instruction set computing.
Yeah, for me, I think it was through Sun, with the Spark architecture. Was, I think, the first time I had heard it, which again, it was like mid-80s. So I'm like, well, what the heck is RISC mean? So,
and it was actually the effort with the Berkeley architecture that actually resulted in the Spark, which was, drove the Suns. I mean, the early Suns were actually, not RISC-based, but this early effort I spoke of resulted in the Spark chip, which was powered the Suns for most of its life.
Berkeley likes to have their version of, like, we got Unix. Oh, we got Berkeley.
BSD,
Unix.
Berkeley.
Forget your AT&T Unix thing. Yeah. Boy, they just love their own versions of things, don't they,
they
Berkeley
do.
People?
They do. Yeah, and so, I guess I'll, just say a few more things about what Apple has done and is doing. I mean, I could actually branch out tempted to branch out in a number of different directions here, but I guess maybe it makes sense again to go down
the list. Is the risk way. I say we just jump ahead to the next thing before you finish this one.
That's right.
And it'll all just work out in the end.
I'm having trouble with branch prediction, actually, so that's what's causing my
quandary. Well, all of your sentences should be exactly the same length, and then we can just do this whole show in parallel.
That's right. Much easier. Parallel execution, without a doubt, without a doubt. So they did this, and it actually, some of the performance issues that you mentioned, Carrington, were due to the fact that, you know, Apple ported Mac OS, you know, certain parts of it from this Motorola 68002, you know, PowerPC, but the vast majority of it was running under emulation. Like, I think initially it was like 80%, 85% of the operating system was running on a quick emulator that, you know, emulated the 68000 processors. And it was fairly easy because the PowerPC was so much more powerful. But still, like with every operating system update, they just, you know, 2% more of the OS has been shifted to native PowerPC and you'd feel performance jumps. So, you know, that was the performance rules were definitely slow in coming. And then again, for other, you know, market reasons, I think a big part of it was, you know, IBM ended up putting resources towards meeting the goals of Sony and Microsoft as far as the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox CPUs. And so they left Apple sort of in the lurch as far as giving them and with the next generation of the PowerPC core what they need. So Apple decided to switch to Intel. Of course, they'd been you know, they had on the back burner the project called Marklar, where they had all along the way, every step of the way, they kept Mac OS X running on Intel, which was obviously an extremely wise thing to do. And I guess,
and you know, they've done the exact same thing now with ARM own processor.
I'm sure that they've had Mac OS running on ARM for a number of years. Certainly, I mean, ever since the iPhone launched. I mean, because the iPhone itself, which came out in, you know, 2007, it ran a subset of Mac OS X. You know, it was its operating system, which was then Phone OS, was a subset of Mac OS X. But anyway, so here we are. That was 2006, and now Apple's been able to create custom silicon that is incredibly performant and very thermally, like very low thermal demands, very low power demands, and they, with the iPhone, the iPad, and so now they've decided to switch over, and, you know, run, turn the entire Mac environment over to ARM within 2 years. I don't want to keep rambling on here, so I'll just, a couple of more points I wanted to make about this particular strain. When they switched, from PowerPC to Intel, they had a Rosetta emulator, it was called, and it emulated, you know, PowerPC code could be run under the Intel-based Mac OS, and it was rather smooth, actually. And I think I mentioned on an earlier episode of this show, I believe, that you know, one of the things that when people were interviewed when Steve Jobs died, you know, people, the reactions to it, one of the things Bill Gates had said about him, and you know, Bill Gates always, it was always back and forth with him. He always had issues that Jobs wasn't a programmer, you know, decades ago, and they were obviously, there's a history. But he said that basically, without the company, without missing a beat, completely transferred an entire, you know, like a massive ecosystem from one CPU architecture to another that were completely unrelated, without missing a beat. Smooth, users basically felt nothing. And he said, you know, he basically did that. So that was the greatest thing, you know, that he could say about the guy, was that this is basically an impossible task to have done so smoothly. And here we are again. And I think, my guess is it's only going to become, you know, a smoother process, based on lessons learned. And, you know, now we have Rosetta 2, which is the other way around. You know, it's an emulator that will be supported for a good many years, I'm sure, as people transition. But, so it's something that Apple's done a number of times. And as we'll talk about in a few minutes, kind of in relation to Apple, this has also happened in different capacities. That's kind of the big news here, in the tech world right now. And, you know, it's interesting to see, how that goes. But one thing I will say is, you mentioned running Windows, Carrington, because right now, with everything being Intel-based, you're running Windows using virtualization. So certain hardware capabilities in the Intel chips of recent years that allow you to, you know, switch contexts because Windows is Intel, Mac OS is Intel, but that's no longer the case. You know, it's not going to be virtualization. Like, I run Windows certainly daily, especially in my current situation with the work at home. And now we're back to emulation. That's straight up emulation, you know. So you're having a foreign operating system that needs to be well emulated under, you know, a host that's running a different architecture. So we'll see how the performance goes on that. But that is, you raise a good point. That's certainly something a lot of people, including myself, will have an eye on. Anyway, I feel like I've gone on a little bit too long on that, but I'll pass it off.
I'm sure we all remember how well Soft PC ran.
Soft PC. Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, I was thinking that the like my experience with the switch to PowerPC, I don't know, I didn't like it very much in a way, because
didn't like the switch or didn't like PowerPC?
Well, it kind of went to both, because it's like what Carrington mentioned, I think, that we had this marketing that said, like, we have this great new chip, you know, this is super powerful, everything's going to be great, you know. You can upgrade your current Mac to a 603A, or whatever it is, 601A, or whatever the one was where when you upgraded, everything got half as fast. And that is specifically, I think, is the thing that kind of soured me on it. It's like, you know, I got a machine that had the PowerPC, and it was not good. And it was, you know, slow to use, because everything was emulated. And by the time things sped up, I'd already kind of like soured on the idea of, you know, like at that point, it was just sort of incremental upgrades, like updates like you always had. I mean, it didn't rehabilitate the PowerPC in my mind, because that time had already passed. It was just, you know, now the computer's faster. Maybe this was mostly just me, but I mean, like, I really didn't, I was not that impressed with the move to PowerPC because it really did feel like, whatever technical achievement is happening, it's making my life slower.
I'll say in response, like, it's interesting. I don't actually have an experience in that time dealing with those machines hands on. At that point, I'd actually switched to a Intel based machine, but, and this ties into later, it was running NextStep for Intel. It was Intel. My girlfriend at the time had like the 6100, you know, which is one of the first Power Macs that had the PowerPC 601. I saw a little bit of that, and it didn't blow my mind as far as speed, but again, it was a low-end machine. But yeah, it's interesting to hear your opinion and yours, Carrington, because I was not using a Mac at that point, you know, and yeah.
Well, I was, and I think I've talked about this on previous episodes, but I had at the time, so 1993, my main computer was a Quadra 840 AV, top of the line screamer of a Macintosh, like just delightful. It was a Motorola 68040, the full one, 40 megahertz. So it's like the fastest Mac ever to be produced. Had this great DSP. I think it was the 3210 that handled video in and video out. It was like, that's what the AV was for. It was my first computer to have an internal CD-ROM drive. I think it was my first computer to ship with the OS on a CD, so it felt like super futuristic. It's like, you don't get a bunch of floppies. Yeah. Here's your CD with an wow. OS. That's amazing. It was definitely my first computer to run only 32-bit. There wasn't even an option to go back to 24-bit. It was a future-looking computer, fast as heck, totally gorgeous mini tower. It was my the first one I had to support plain talk, so I had speech recognition. Yeah, it wasn't good, but whatever. I could hold down the escape key and say, tell me a joke, and the computer would tell me a joke. Like, this was amazing to me. And I got it with the something called an AudioVision 14 display. It was like 14-inch monitor, because that was big enough for me for a lot of years, weirdly. Mm-hmm. And but it had these great inbuilt speakers and multiple audio jacks. I mean, it's just a screamer of a delight of a computer. Still one of the favorite computers I've ever owned, one of the best Macs ever made. And what did I do to it? I lobotomized it. I went to this Apple meeting, and they were talking about the Power Macs, and it's the future, and it's going to be amazing. And so I bought into that and got the kit to change my 840 AV into a PowerMac 8100/80AV. So I'm thinking I'm going from 40 megahertz to 80 megahertz. This is going to be amazing. And it was not. I turned my screamer computer into a dog slow first generation Power Mac that just, and everything I was doing was just running an emulation. So suddenly everything is slower. I spent something like $1,500 to do this. It was just such a mistake. Like one of the silliest mistakes ever made, because moving to a new architecture, I'm going from a robust top of the line, you know, really well-polished computer to the first model of a fast-moving architecture. So within like year and a half, 2 years, the 8500-200 is out. So there's something that's more than twice as fast as my poor little computer. And I'm like, I'm just being left in the dust. And it was such a mistake. I had a very different experience with the move to Intel. Everything seemed to be quick and just like I bought into it and everything was great. And I think that's how the next move is going to go. But the move to PowerPC was a big stumbling block for me at the time, because I took my beautiful computer and I turned it into a slow little Frankenstein, and I still owe an apology for that. So, yeah, what can you do? Yeah.
And I think, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, as I know you're well aware, but one of the key differences is the approach. Like with as far as 85% or so of the original, the first Mac OS, Mac, or I guess it was, System 7 or System 8, whatever system was running, when they switched to PowerPC, right, that was emulating. But the way we do it now is different. It's not actually emulation, and we'll talk about that as we get down to some of the others. So yes, I think it'll be a lot smoother, and that's why this approach is why the Intel switch was smoother.
Yeah, exactly. Generally. And with the first Rosetta and with the Intel, the whole universal binary things, yep. Different approach.
Approach.
Just made it such a difference. A much better approach. Yeah. Exactly. And I anticipate that's what's going to happen. Right. Can I ask you, Blake, were you develop, or either of you, were you guys developers back then? Did you have access to the Apple developer? There's Apple developer platform was, I think, the first one, like back then, to move to Intel. And now it's the developer transition kit is the current one, the little Mac minis that let you. I mean, I've never had either of them, so I don't know. Do you guys, did you get it at the time?
No, I did the basic, like paid like $100 a year to get access to deploy things to like an iPhone or something. But,
I did that
no,
too.
No, I didn't, yeah. I didn't do the, cause they'd send you a Pentium 4 in a tower, like a G5 tower, and you have to send it back to them, which is the same thing that they're doing now with this Mac Mini.
The little ARM Mac Mini, yeah.
And you do have to send it back to them at the end.
You don't get to keep it. You're basically paying to rent it, yeah.
Yeah, so, no, I didn't get
that. So Apple we've talked a lot about Apple stuff, but Apple isn't the only company to do this kind of thing. I think they're just the most famous and maybe the most successful at it, at least in this term. Other people seem to say they're on an operating system, and they say, okay, now we're going to go to that. And so they just say, oh, here's our new version of everything. They're not really just saying, hey, you're just going to, as a customer, just keep buying and you're fine. You can mix and match. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's made Apple's approach different, like from a consumer standpoint.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly based on the success with the 2006 switch to Intel, Apple's not very worried about issues. Their ducks are in a row, it's fine. Mm-hmm. But it's a huge undertaking. I mean, if you think about it, Apple is Apple. Not a lot of companies could probably pull this off.
And they're moving to the architecture that runs currently their more popular platform. So they're moving over to the thing that runs the iPad and the iPhone. And so I think there's also less risk there. They're not going to something else.
Did you say there's less risk there? Oh my God. I almost fell out of the chair.
But so you know what I mean? Like the sense, everyone keeps saying, like, when are they going to basically drop the Mac and go to the iPad and whatever? And so I think shuffling it over towards this, there is less risk. I know there's another word for it. I just can't think of it at the moment. And so because of that, they said, okay, we'll just, our laptops are going to be big iPads. So it'll be interesting to see, like, 10 years from now, what has come out of this. It's hard to anticipate, but no doubt it's a blurring of the two platforms, I think.
So. And I think I wanted to, there's an observation, and before we, I want us to move on, to some of the other items, but I was talking with a friend, technical fellow, and, talking about, again, I thought it was going to be like MacBook Air, MacBook would be ARM for a while, and then, Intel, and then maybe in 2-3 years, we'd move it on. But they're talking about everything, including, and that's going to include the Power Mac. You know, that,
that's the one that surprised me. I didn't think their super high-end, highest of the high-end would be moving to
ARM. Well, it's interesting to see because, you know, they can create their own silicon. So they can do what they want. Like, they could create – I mean, with the Power Mac, there's no concern for – and again, well, this is
– Are we talking about the Mac Pro?
Yes, I've been saying Power Mac.
Yeah, I see Power Mac. You know, I see Power Mac too. Right.
Sorry, we're everyone. Old. The Mac Pro, the Mac Pro, the big super cheese grater with the wheels, and maybe if you want them. So you know, Apple's taken a lot of steps to show that they're much more interested in consumer than prosumer. You know, they sort of dumbed down the interface on a number of their high end, creation applications. A lot of the pros were, you know, not really happy about it. They waited so long, you know, to address the Mac Pro issue with the trash can and then moving it up to the next one. I was actually surprised that they came out with another Mac Pro. Like, I actually didn't expect there to be another Mac Pro. So it'll be interesting to see whether they choose to fabricate, there's no thermal concerns. There's no power concerns with those units. So it's wide open for like a Mac Pro. No one cares how much power it draws, how hot it gets, but they could, whether they, you know, actually create these custom, like, you know, 32 core chips, ARM chips, or given that they've shown that, yes, they came out with a new Mac Pro, but they, you know, they're clearly more targeting, consumer, not so much professional. It'll be interesting to see whether, you know, here comes the new Mac Pro. It has four physical, you know, 8-core CPUs in it, you know, rather than 32. Like, I wonder if they're going to, not that that's taking a weak approach, but, you know, it's not taking the most robust approach. It'll be interesting to see how custom they get just for that segment, because, you know, that's a segment that wants like a 32-core CPU, and that's not a CPU they could use in any of their other machines. So it'll be interesting to see if they, you know, kind of piece together some of the, you know, the lower spec items, or I'm interested in seeing how that goes. So
I remember the time when the move to PowerPC to Intel, Steve Jobs and a lot of people kept saying, like, one of the main reasons we're doing this, when we look at the roadmap ahead, the power per watt will be so much greater on Intel because they could really see everything's moving portable. Everything's going smaller. Apple in particular wants everything as thin as heck, and it doesn't matter if the battery lasts 15 minutes.
To a fault, perhaps.
And so that whole power per watt, and that's really the thing I think they're going to get with the move to ARM as well. So I worry that, oh, they're going to be great. We can be just as powerful as before, but thinner and lighter, versus saying, hey, we can be way more powerful because we don't have to worry. I think they'll just go keep the same and just make it thinner, make it lighter, make it last longer. Yeah. That's always been their priority. It's not my priority, but it's what you get.
They might in doing that.
That's like, my bet.
The absolute, you know, power people that are trying to sequence DNA in their closet. I mean, they might lose some of those guys, you know, as far as, you know, the Threadripper CPUs that AMD has out there. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I can on my iPhone 11, I can kick out 4K video post, you know, process faster than I can on this iMac here, this 2017 iMac. I mean, it actually will process the video faster. And and it does it without a heat sink, and it does it, you know, it doesn't get warm in my hand. You know, that's crazy.
My current iPad, I think, is the fastest computer I own, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, it's definitely a different situation, but.
Yeah. So let's see. The idea of like keeping the same power and just making it thinner and thinner. Mm-hmm. I think of that as being the problem with all set-top cable boxes. The power is in the hardware is just a little bit less than what it needs. So no matter what, you know, how modern a cable box you have, it still goes draw, 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 page, like, page, page, page.
Yeah, you're, so I think you're right about that.
The other thing, too, I was thinking about the as in the impending architecture switch, I sort of feel like Apple – well, my experiences with Apple, I assume that this actually may happen in Windows World too, but I feel a little bit prepared for it because they have been doing this kind of like staged obsolescence of 32-bit apps and things, right? So like last time around, we had a thing that said, you know, just be aware this isn't going to run forever. And then, you know, if you upgrade now, it doesn't run anymore, you know? And so you're sort of, as far as the user is concerned, that's the same. That's the exact same kind of switch. I mean, you have to move to a version of the app that matches your new machine, whether it's in bit count or architecture, they don't care.
Yeah. My family, for the most part, was completely unaware. They've always been Apple households because I'm their tech support, so I tell them what to get. And the movement from Motorola to PowerPC, they didn't notice. It was just, there's the faster computer. Moved to Intel, my mom would have no idea. Her next computer will be an ARM computer. She will have no idea. All of this has been behind the scenes. Most people don't care the way we care.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really excited about it, yeah. But my get your bingo cards ready. My girlfriend is surprised how excited I am about an ISA transition, and I keep trying to tell her, and she glazes over. So that sounds interesting, but I don't think most people care about the architecture at all.
I was at a week at the beach. I was a week at the far end of a distanced beach in Delaware when this hit. I forgot WWDC was even happening, and I start seeing tweets about 2 years to ARM, and it's like early on the vacation.
To ARM myself? What?
And I'm caught off guard, and so I'm going, come in off the beach, spend the whole night reading and watching videos and learning. And I'm sitting down there with my family, my wife, my daughter, my brother-in-law and his fiance. I'm trying to just explain in the lightest terms, like what this is. And no one had, there was no concern or care at all. Like my daughter was like, are you going to mention that every day? Like, and it's like, why don't you go call one of your geek friends? She's like, why don't, she said, maybe you should get the podcast people to do a show, right in the middle of the trip.
And here we are.
Yeah. So, yes, I think you're very on hitting the nail on the head as far as
people. I suspect it's really the same with most of our listeners, though. I bet if you're into retro computers, you probably have also always been the tech person in your family, the computer geek in your group. And you too probably get excited about these things, transitions to or away from things or whatever, and nobody else around you cares at all. But we understand you and we love you. So right. It's all good. This is a safe space. Yeah. We all get excited about the same stuff.
Okay.
So who else has done this kind of thing?
Other people besides Apple exist and have done
it. Other people besides Apple exist.
Next. Going very far afield.
Other people so different than Apple, such as Next. Excellent. Baby steps away from Apple. That's right, because NextStep and OpenStep and stuff, that's mm-hmm. that was on a few different architectures, right? I'm kind of outside of that world.
Yeah. I'm on the edge, and I think Blake is inside that world.
Okay, so teach me. Tell
all
me
right,
about
it. I'll say a few words here. I've got a... Yeah, so NextStep, which OpenStep is what you call the more recent versions of NextStep, basically. That's the operating system upon which Mac OS X was based, basically, when Steve Jobs, came back to Apple and Next took over Apple for negative $45 million, or however you want to put it, when Apple bought Next, but really it was the other way around. So before, the whole Next into Apple thing, the Next operating system, NextStep, which technically debuted in 1988, was on Motorola hardware. It was, they called it the black hardware is what it came to be known in retrospect, after the architecture started expanding, they were, physically painted Next Black, which is a Pantone color. I think that's the name, Next Black. It's not quite black.
Oh, interesting. Very, I did not
very,
know that.
Very dark gray. Very dark cool. gray. So they were sexy machines.
Apple should make a Vanta Black computer. I would totally buy that.
Yeah,
like, where's my computer? I have no idea where it is. It's in a dark room.
Like darkness within darkness. Yeah.
Great. And they would no doubt charge more for it, and I would no doubt pay more for it. So I am the exact sucker for that.
I think they would have to charge a little bit more for that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure about that.
They wouldn't. No, or it could be cheaper because they could simply sell you a very dark, empty box. So, you let it out.
You
must have dropped
it. Yeah.
Feel around for it.
You couldn't see it. What are you talking about? So they did the Motorola thing, and then the hardware, the software architecture was amazing. The development environment was amazing, but the hardware was too weak and too expensive. Really, when you look at it compared to other workstations, Suns, certain, SGIs. So they tried to branch out. And so what they did was they ported the operating. Now, this wasn't via emulation. And this is getting to how Apple's is doing this today. What they did, they created this system they called Fat Binaries. And what it was you take your code base and it had a very robust development environment, if you had the NextStep developer package. And you'd write your code, and you could then compile it for the next machines, the black hardware, but you could also compile it for several other architectures. And by the time they were done, there were three other architectures. There was Intel x86. So you could just tick a box, and effectively it would compile. And it's a shame Jack's not here to talk. He actually, I was not a, I mean, I did a little for fun, but he was a professional, I think. Anyway, so you tick a box in the developer, and it would create the output, the resulting binary. It would be one file, or actually next executables are really a directory, just like Mac OS X executables are actually a directory. And it would have all the resources and binaries needed to run on the Motorola systems and also to run on the Intel system. So the same program, the same file, the same app would be, you could take to one machine, take to another, and they have nothing to do with each other architecture-wise, and it would run. The proper code would run on that system. The beige hardware was called the white hardware. I called it beige hardware. I think it was black hardware is Motorola, white hardware is Intel. There was green hardware, which was the HP PA RISC systems, and green because the code name for that machine was the Gecko. That was actually a RISC scenario. So I have behind me a Motorola, a Next Station, running it, you know, I think 33 megahertz. And I also have behind me the green hardware, the HP RISC running at 100 megahertz. And it's astounding. It's much more than the difference between 33 megahertz and 100 megahertz, the performance jump. It's something like 10 times faster because you're getting the RISC advantage. And it's amazing how fast that runs. And the other architecture, and I don't know what color they called it. I looked it up, but I couldn't find it. I don't remember. Was Spark. You could install NextStep on certain Spark Station Sun units. So it's possible, and there were a good many applications that supported this, that a developer would write code, he had like a Motorola machine, he'd tick all the boxes, and he'd upload it to the FTP site, and people could run it on all their different platforms. And this is called a fat binary. And the thing was, of course, you know, people sitting on an Intel system have, you know, certain resources for three other platforms that they don't own sitting on their hard drive. But this was at the point where storage was becoming cheap enough that it really didn't matter. The convenience of having everything in one place just made it so that it wasn't a huge deal. So there was some bloat, but that kept things tidy in such a way that the community as a whole benefited. And so, yes, Apple took that approach when they did the PowerPC to Intel, but they called it universal binaries. It was exactly the same thing. Certain resources are shared. There's two different executable trees in that you know file set, and that's what they're going to do with with the ARM, Intel to ARM. So you'll have two separate sets. So when something has been written and compiled, and oh, we've updated this to support the new Mac OS and the new ARM. It's not emulating. Like, it's running native. It's running optimized native code for both. The emulation scenario I mentioned earlier was, yes, if you want to, in a window, run another operating system, like Microsoft right. Windows, that is going to have to be emulated. But native, you know, Mac OS software written for the Mac will, unlike, you know, in the early days, it won't be emulated. It'll all be native, and that's why it should also be smooth. But they got that from Next.
The other thing that Next transitioned is over the years, I have never been able to nail down what is supposed to be capitalized in their name. Because in many official things, it's sometimes just the N and the S, sometimes the N, the X, and the T, some the N, X, T, and S, sometimes it's all capitalized. Uh-huh. I remember for a long time in the late 90s, it was like everything except the first E was capitalized. Yeah. It's like, what are you doing? So that's kind of like a poorly handled transition where I never was sure how to camel case Next Step.
Yeah, I remember. I don't know.
Get your stuff together, Next.
Or like Next Station. I mean, like, what is the first S of Station.
Yeah, I think I type it differently each time. I actually looked up the Next thing once. I don't know about OpenStep, but Next Step, it ended up in the end, technically Next Step is all caps. But I think because looking back and given that people are trying to set some context, I think even people that are aware of that use the little E because then you know what you're talking about, you know. It's like if you do a search. You go do a search for Next Step. you know, you're not going to, that's a terrible
thing. Google say, do you mean next step?
Yeah, like, right.
No, exactly. All one word. But, never heard of it.
I think it's technically all cats, but.
Okay.
I seem to recall the term fat binary being used in the Mac context.
Do you?
I mean, like, I don't
heard that too.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other thing I was thinking about with these fat binaries is that I at least, maybe this was just me, but I certainly fell for the bloat, you know, and there were plenty of applications, you know, like, you know, the cheap little applications that everybody makes their own version of that would go through your hard drive
strip
out all the stuff that you didn't need.
I never ran those, but I totally remember those. Yes.
Would they get in there and strip out the other binaries from your...
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I saw you.
And they would turn stuff from universal to just one thing.
As I was mentioning the bloat aspect, I saw a slight smirk on Paul's face, and I almost stopped to ask.
Yes.
But I guess I personally don't remember, you know...
We weren't rolling in hard drives like you, Blake.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Floppy bags.
And it's possible, actually, in this new... transition, we might have that problem again. I mean, like, there's a sense in which, you know, storage is infinite and all that and blah, blah, you know, because, you know, we live in the future. But also, all of these new computers have these, like, mini,
SSDs.
Tiny little flash drives in them now.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Like, you know, everything
That's a good point.
Yeah, we live in a world where storage is infinite, and yet I can't get my sister to back up anything. So, there's the world.
Yeah. No, you're right. I've got a little tiny 256, you know, gigabyte, you know, boot disk that's in this system, but like...
Young Blake would like to point out that you just said tiny 256 gigabytes.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. But you're right. That's a good point. You make a good point. Yeah. I wonder if they have a compression approach or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I noticed that because I've been fighting... Like, I have a Mac Mini that I'm running as like a media server, and it's really quite small. I'm constantly writing at like 20 gigabytes free on this disk because it was only 120 to begin with. And so like, I don't want a bunch of like other architectures in my apps.
Right.
Yeah.
You got your other architecture in my app. Anyway. Yeah.
So Paul, in the show notes, you've mentioned the Dimension 68,000.
Somebody did.
Oh, I thought it was you. I'm just like, so, Blake, was this you? You wanted one so badly? I've never even heard of this thing. What is the Dimension 68,000 that you wanted so badly?
It's not really what we're talking about here. Like, it's in the same neighborhood. It was just a 68,000-based machine that looks like a, you know, a slab PC that came out in, like, 1984. And it has its own little custom operating system, 68,000 based, but it was built and advertised saying, oh, plug in this card, it'll run Apple II software. Plug in this, it'll run IBM PC software. Here's a Z80 card.
Wait, the cards were emulators or the cards were...
They were hard. They had the CPUs on them. They were...
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so that was the thought. And I remember...
That must have been expensive.
Yeah. It's a nice looking, it's a handsome, you know, looking box. But it's, there was just an interesting, I remember reading the review and the reviewer was being really harsh on it. And then this is Creative Computing, and he, contacted the company. They said, well, you know, I think there were some performance issues with some of the foreign platforms. And they said, well, why don't you review it also as, you know, it is a 68,000 based machine and that's part of it. And he said, well, that's true. And then I think it looked a little faster, but, yeah, and I think I believe there's an InfoWorld article that Paul linked to, which basically the title tells you what you need to know: jack of all trades, but master of none. You know, so it's it was an interesting. I'd never seen something like this before, and it came to mind. But again, it's not really transitioning from one OS to another, but it's a little detail that I thought might be interesting to mention.
That's similar to like the Apple II had, because we can't get away from Apple, my God. Yeah, I had the same thing where you could stick cards in to run CPM or Z80 or whatever.
I guess everybody had a CPM card, right? I mean, almost like...
Everything has a CPM card.
Yeah.
Everything. I have one in me at the moment.
Yes, no doubt.
Delicious, delicious CPM.
Well, and I think... You know, those early like S100 machines also often had their processor on one of the cards. You know, it was like you had a video card and you had a processor card, and it didn't have to be the same processor in different machines. I mean,
that's true. Yeah, the S100 is basically just like, here's a bunch of slots. Let's have a computer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there were a number of different. But I think typically you thought of Z80 CPM as the OS for S100 machines, I think. Right?
I did. Yes.
Okay. Agreed. I'm looking through our little list of things, trying to see what is most distant from Apple, and I see BOS and I see Palm. And I'm like, man. Uh-huh.
Even ARM. Like, we've got some notes about the ARM and the origin of ARM. Okay, so Blake, maybe you'll know this. I have never been able to get straight. ARM, does it stand for Acorn Risk Machine or Advanced Risk Machine? Because I swear I've seen official things say both. And also see something say that it stands for nothing, that it's just whatever.
It initially stood for Acorn Risk Machine. That's absolutely okay. The case. And then it became more broadly licensed, and the name was changed to Advanced Risk Machines, plural. But and I guess I can just, Paul, shall I just give the little tidbit of info that we have for ARM on this one?
Sure. That's fine.
Since we're here, we're kind of all over the place. Sorry, listeners. But
you can just take that as a blanket statement for all the episode. Sorry, listeners.
Welcome to the RCR.
Exactly. So I had been under the impression until quite recently that the first RISC processor was created by Acorn, but that's not the case. They were inspired by the Berkeley group that we talked about earlier. Berkeley.
Previously, I always historically thought of ARM as the inventors of RISC.
When I say that until recently, I'm referring to about 2 hours ago. I was under the impression until 2 hours ago that they had bunked it up themselves. But no, they heard of the West Coast. They knew it all goes down at Berkeley, and they roll their own way out there.
They'd go to a Dead concert, they'd make an ISA. How things roll.
They followed right behind it. I mean, they might have been the second, they might have been, right on the.
Because it would be super early, because they would have had it going. I mean, I heard of RISC, I think, through Spark, and I heard of ARM through the Newton, as I think the first time I heard of ARM stuff.
That's right.
So it's all really early things.
Yeah. Yeah. So they had the most well-known computer that Acorn created was called the BBC Micro, and it was, funded in part by the British Broadcasting Company. It was used in schools everywhere, and they had a small attempt to market it in the US, I remember, but it didn't really take. Based on the 6502, which is surprising for a European machine, but at any rate, a machine created in Europe. At any rate, the machine was designed with, of course, it had expansion capabilities, but one of the specific capabilities that it was built with was the ability to have a guest CPU, like a different CPU, come in and take control and work with in tandem with the current CPU. It's kind of a unusual feature to have, right from the get-go. But so you saw a number of different CPUs in different capacities, Project-y appear. But one of them, so basically they use this capability to create the original ARM processor hanging off the side of the BBC Micro. So they were able to test. And so they had a very basic original. And they used apparently a lot of the reading into this earlier. They did used a lot of the design methodology, the notions, the mindset of 6502 design. They actually visited the Western Design Center, which was just a husband and wife, and talked to them, and they got enough, kind of assurance that in their own minds that they could, take this to a different level with. And so they created the original ARM, the ARM-1. I don't know if it was called the ARM-1 or if that was, a name applied later, but they created this RISC processor, and then with that, interestingly, they ran like the CAD software for CPU design to more quickly run the design software on that BBC Micro in order to develop the ARM2. So like they created the first ARM to speed up the BBC Micro in order to design the ARM2. And then the ARM2, I think, was the first actual, I believe, from what I can tell, was the first actual ISA that they put out. It became a CPU. And then, as Carrington mentioned, the biggest, I think the biggest commercial success or, acknowledged market presence was when Apple took the ARM 610 and ran it, I think it was 20 or 25 megahertz, and ran it in the Newton because they needed that power for handwriting recognition, because that was a real-time thing, and you know, it was quite a fast machine for the time, processor for the time. But that was, yeah, so I think that's, and then ARM, you know, certain things happened, some technology changed hands, the strong ARM was developed, which was over 100 megahertz, it became like the Newton MessagePad 2000, and they were building some work, they have their Acorn Archimedes series, which were like Amiga-like desktops, actually more powerful than the Amiga, RISC-based, and they were running, you know, RISC OS and, you know, this GUI operating system that ran quite fast, and that kind of progressed all the way to, I think the last one was called the RISC PC. Yeah, but anyway, so that's, yeah, it is definitely, the ARM today is definitely derived from what was Acorn RISC machine. The
Acorn RISC machine. Yeah. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and Apple's been in that since super early days, because I remember it was them that put the, it was like they had the money, and I think the Acorn people or whatever were the tech, and they all worked out of a barn or something. I think it's like the UK. I'm all the people in the UK are currently shouting at their headphones. But it's like in North America, everyone wants to talk about a couple of people in a garage or whatever. But I think the famous equivalent in the rest space is those dozen engineers in a barn in Cambridge or something took all the money from Apple and then made all this ARM stuff. So,
mm-hmm. Is this the like what the movie Microman was about?
I think Microman, I don't believe I was about to mention Microman. I don't think they get so much into the ARM. I think that's more the BBC Micro folks, I believe, were with Sinclair, as I recall. Right. And then they branched off and then created, you know, BBC Micro and their own thing. So, but I don't think it got into ARM. Good movie.
Interesting. Yeah. No, it's I kind of want to go watch that again.
Yeah. I need to obviously see it again. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess so. Another thing that's in here is Palm that adopted ARM. ARM's going to take over the world.
Well, it kind of already has.
Which I wouldn't have predicted back yeah. in the day. Ask me late 80s, I wouldn't have said it's all going to be ARM in the end.
I mean,
and now I'm thinking it might all be ARM in the end.
It's, you know, it's for some time it's been the most widely used you know, processor architecture, because your car has like 20 ARM chips, your refrigerator, this microphone, you know, like everything. Whatever that thing is over there. Yeah, it's everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Until the apocalypse hits, and then we are all stuck using those old Z80s and collapse OS.
But ARM is yeah. like, it's like with computer languages. ARM is one of those things where I know that it's huge, I know it's everywhere, but it's like C, where I have to remind myself C is still like that and Java go back and forth, but it's like still the number one language out there. And you don't think of that, right? But it's just because it's in everything. Mm-hmm. And I think about, no, computers are, I'm still old enough to think a computer is a big thing on a desktop, ooh, like I'm a grandpa. But like everything else, no, computers are everywhere. They're just floating in the air and we're breathing them in and they're all ARM-based and whatever. I looked at the Toyobi index recently and to see what the most popular languages were. And I tried to name them ahead of time. I'm like, okay, it's going to be like C, Java, and then it's going to be like C sharp and C++ because everyone's using those, and JavaScript, of course, because that's on everything everywhere. And it turns out it was like number five was something like Visual Basic. I'm like, what? how is Visual Basic still the fifth most used one? And then there was R was something like the sixth or seventh. I'm like, what the heck is R? I am so out of the world now. Like, there's a language that's like a top 10 language that I never even heard of before. And I clearly have to go back to school because I'm like, what the heck?
Yeah. R is it's basically a statistics scripting language. So I mean it's
for stealing my data.
Oh, yeah, so it's basically you know, data scientists that are using this.
Oh yeah, but how many of those are there? Like what the heck, man?
Why is that apparently
so
a lot.
So I guess because everybody wants to get all the stats from everybody's use of everything. But I was like so surprised. I was like, where the heck did this language come out of, and how have I never even heard of it before?
Yeah.
So
yeah. I keep seeing
pick a very ungoogleable project R. name too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right.
Very nice. Yeah.
It's pirate's language.
Yeah, I keep seeing Rust mentioned. I embarrassingly don't know what that is. Yep. You know, I have no idea what that is, but
at least things like Go and Rust and stuff, and Swift, like, in the new thing. I'm like, I've heard of them before. MATLAB. I'm like, okay, I don't use it. I at least have heard of it. But I'm like, what the heck is R? When somebody comes like, how can it be so popular? And I literally don't think I'd come across it. So anyway, Visual Basic, still, I think it's like a number five or number six most popular language out there. I don't understand the world. Anyway, same thing with – the whole point was ARM seems like that. It's just in everything, so you forget that it's there.
Yeah.
Also, just on the history of RISC, so Greg in our chat had mentioned that might have been a researcher at IBM who invented RISC, so, and rather than Berkeley. And I don't actually know what the connection is exactly, but the person is John Cock.
Okay.
Who spent most of his – or maybe all of his career as an industrial researcher for IBM. So that's kind of – but – that may still be connected to these Berkeley people.
Oh, these Berkeley people.
Okay.
So I don't quite know what this story is exactly, but there is actually a person whose name is associated with coming up with RISC.
Okay.
Okay. But he might even he probably like invented it in the 70s and then people made it in the 80s or something. Yeah, that's how things work.
Let us imagine some histories.
Yeah. I
imagine that it was stolen from him.
That's right.
And I'm on his side. Yeah. I think we've got to take it back.
I saw some vague, you know, some indications that, you know, at some decades in the past, like some of the notions of what, you know, what RISC could be, you know, is sort of this different approaches. Like here, the idea of using a more simple, you know, instruction set instead of complex. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say, you know, I'm certainly not doubting the John Cock, but yeah, I'm sure there was, you know, some of the tenets of what it pulled together, people had been talking about for a while.
I would like to go down as the inventor of CISC, but it's CISC with an S. It's the singular instruction set. I think things have gotten too complicated.
There you go.
Should be a chip that just has like one instruction. And I can understand it, but I'm old.
Carrington, the Amiga's copper. The graphics coprocessor has four instructions. That's all. Just four.
That's three too many, you Amiga people.
Yeah. Getting close.
Three of them are a wait.
You're right. One is wait, one is go. Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes it feels like the 8-bit Ataris have an instruction that's just like game or something. It's like I made this, it's got 7,000 sprites. That took me one line of basic. I'm like, you people.
Yeah. Yeah, I do remember. I feel like I probably mentioned this repeatedly, but a friend of mine had I think it was a Commodore 64. It might have been a VIC-20, but I remember just being blown away by the fact that you could define a sprite and then put it anywhere on the screen, and it would just, you know, move around freely.
It would
freely.
Just be a sprite.
I mean, what is this? You know, I had to do a lot of work to do something even half as good looking.
Yeah, I remember trying to like just do blitting on an Apple II, and I was like, why is these other people have sprites? What is happening?
Custom graphics.
Apple
hardware.
II can make one sound, and it's almost impossible to get it to do it. It's like, come on, man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
None of those pesky linear frame buffers.
Yeah. No. So in our show notes, there's an interesting article I want to draw everyone's attention to that takes another tack on this. Because I was looking for, like, what are other things in computer architecture, and has somebody else switched over? And that led me to the home of the CACM, it's the Communications of the ACM. ACM stands for Association of Computing Machinery. So that is a scholarly publication that has been going since the 1950s. It's a monthly magazine, never missed. It's currently at issue something like 13,400 and something. Like, it's just insane. And it is amazing. I immediately became hooked. Like, this is just, if you're interested in like deep dives into computing and stuff you would have heard of, like Google just fixed this or whatever, but then looking at AI ethics and just crazy stuff. Very fascinating. And there was a really interesting article published recently called A New Golden Age for Computer Architecture, kind of exploring this, like computer architectures and changes and things. And one of the things it focused on was the way architectures adjacent to the main architecture of computer keep changing and become more important. So things like GPUs. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that has changed. So you've got, like, instead of your CPU changing, the graphics stuff changes and then gets used for other stuff, not just games. Let's do bitcoins and many other things. But it looked at the real way to approach these, and that usually an architectural change is not even remotely worth doing because the way we create stuff on the current architecture we're using is normally so inefficient that we can get a much better and bigger bang for our buck by just being better at that. Don't switch to new chips. The chip you're using doesn't even remotely matter if you're good enough at what doing it. And the way they demonstrated this was to take something on a current high-end Intel multi-core thing and say, okay, let's just run it. And they got and see how fast things work in, say, Python. Really popular. It's awesome. They said, okay, now let's see what could we get if we switch that to a different architecture and what would be our returns on other things that are faster. And you can get a many times faster result, but it's much better. They said, let's do four things. We'll rewrite it in C. Bingo, immediate 47 times faster. Yeah. They used parallel loops so you can run it on multiple cores, another 7 times faster. Then they optimized it to do, they optimized the memory layout so that you're going to be exploiting caches in particular, 20 times faster because of that. And then they just used a couple of hardware extensions instead just to do SNOID, so when you're doing the same instruction on multiple data things at once, another 9 times. So that doesn't sound like a bunch, but if you take 47 times faster, then make it 7, and then another 20, then 9 times more, it's 64,000 times faster. So he said, like, we can take the same thing on the same computer and get a 64,000 times return on our investment by doing that. And even if you don't do all these, it's really easy to make things go anywhere from 100 to 1,000 times faster. And the architecture changes are almost never worth the investment. Yeah. So that was interesting. So they come down hard on the, this is silly, don't do that, just become better programmers.
I think that's definitely becoming a better programmer is like becoming like a PS3 cell processor ninja. Like I think you're right, but I think they're
but just do that. But it's so much easier to throw interns who know Python at it. They're so cheap and they're just like, you know, it's good enough for now. And I have fallen into that trap myself many times where I have optimized the heck out of something. And then by the time I'm done, it's like, I need that new version now and I'm throwing all this away because my needs have changed. So usually it's better to simply fast and quick as good enough. And then by the time we'd make this quicker, we're just going to buy new hardware or whatever. So I typically am myself just throwing hardware at things. So. But the scholars say, become a better programmer.
ACM, by the way, is that is like the preeminent, you know, computer science academic organization.
I immediately got hooked and immediately subscribed. I read through a couple of things. I'm like, I'm subscribing. This one issue is blowing my mind. I just ate up everything in it and immediately become a subscriber. I don't think I'm going to go and try to get 13,000 back issues, but I might just pick it up from here. So I am now a monthly subscriber to communications of the ACM.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. It's possible, as we tick past the first hour, that we can move on beyond the host topic to some of the other things that we have.
Excellent.
All right.
So in listener feedback, we have a couple of things that I'll mention. They're all people who tweeted links to other people's stuff, actually, to us. So that's all right. So Niels on Twitter pointed out something that someone named John Kennedy is working on, which is making an Altair 8800 in Unity for a future virtual computer museum. And so there's a tweet, I guess we'll have a link to the tweet in the show notes, that it's basically just a virtual, like, 3D, but working Altair 8800 that you can, you know, I think you can program with switches and stuff like that.
Okay, I was going to ask you, like, Unity, like, what I think of as Unity, so it literally is that, like, in the game-making 3D thing? Cool.
Yeah, but I think you can use it for, it's pretty general. I mean, like, you don't have to shoot things.
But you don't have to shoot things, but if you feel like shooting an Altair, then this will be your opportunity.
That's right. Anyway, yeah, so that's kind of neat, and it's a little bit like I think people have done similar kinds of things in Minecraft and stuff like that too. I mean, like, I think it's interesting that there are these sort of development environments that are sophisticated enough that you could embed an entire emulator inside. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I thought it's just kind of it's a neat project, and it's possibly one step cooler than just having an emulated front panel on your computer. If you have an actual little switch, you can.
Sure. Right. Yeah. And it's similar to how people make these things in Minecraft.
Oh, maybe you can actually get like a virtual glove.
Oh, right.
So that you can actually get like.
No. Well, I get to. Does this mean I'm going to get to use an Altair in like games of Call of Duty or something? Like, how is this going to work over to other things?
It's a good question. I think,
you know, I'll be in like the next time I'm in a tournament, I'll be like, you don't have to shoot things. Come and compete with me. I'm going to be a force for change, baby.
That's right. But yeah, that would be sort of a funny sort of side mission or whatever, is that you have to stop your shooting adventure to program in a bootloader. then read some stuff in mock paper tape. Another thing that Niels pointed us to on Twitter is someone's project called Retro Swiper. This is Josh Baker's swipe card game loader. And what it is basically is, like, it's connecting a swipe card thing to, I guess, an emulator. And then the idea is that the cards themselves are like the games that you're going to play on your emulator. So you swipe the card through the swipe card thing, and it will start up that game on the emulator. And at first I thought it was actually reading the code off the card.
But no, it's going to be just typing it, because you can't get a lot of code on a Magstripe.
Yeah, so I think it's basically just making a menu selection without actually having to. So rather than hitting a key, you have to dig around in your little card file, find a card.
Yeah, but that's pretty cool, though, right?
It's like, neat.
I dig it. Yeah.
But it's one of these kind of, you know, because I can kind of projects.
That is a good reason to do something. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Nice. So what's it called again? Retro Swiper. Cool. Good name, too.
Yeah. So there's a GitHub that sort of has the code and stuff like that.
Retro Swiper sounds like I'm going to copy that floppy. I'm a Retro Swiper.
No swiping.
You wouldn't swipe a car. You wouldn't swipe.
Let's see how many cultural references we can branch out of on Swiper. And then I guess the last thing, I didn't look at this too carefully, but the last thing is Matthew on Twitter pointed out a link to Eric Smith, who goes by Brouhaha on Twitter. Eric's project about in ancient history, having built a 68,000 coprocessor card for Apple IIs, and there's a little page about like how that works and how that worked. But apparently this project has been resurrected, and it's, you know, a new PCBs have arrived, and it's quite possible that this will soon be a thing again that you could.
So it's a coprocessor card. What is the processor?
68020 and a 68881.
So you're going to run like Mac stuff on it?
I guess. Yeah.
Cool. My Apple II is now a Mac 2CX. Cool.
I mean, it's quite possible that you can't quite run the Mac stuff without the whole toolbox thing, but.
Right. It's all hosted at 1 MHz or something. That's awesome.
But yeah.
That's neat.
So, because we were talking.
And that's right in line with what we were just talking about. Yeah, exactly. It's the topic that will never end.
Yeah. And then the last bit of feedback is actually going to be moved over to the gift idea. So Bob over email sent us something which turned into a gift idea.
Thank you for the gift idea, Bob. So nice.
We'll hold off on that. And then that'll do for the listener feedback, I think. And we can move on to our items of interest and news. And Blake has the first of these.
Okay. Yeah, I've just got one item for this show. But it's a we talked about, I think, again, it may be an episode that has not appeared, but there was a an eBay item, which was it might have been further back than that, a Texas Instruments Silent 700 data terminal, which was a little compact thing. Basically, it looks like a laptop. It has no screen, and it has a thermal printer. Basically, it looks like a little typewriter, a portable typewriter. And someone is, it sounded appealing to me. I have wanted to get one of these for a while, but someone is demonstrating it in a video. Someone's demonstrating being logged into a bulletin board system on a Texas Instruments Silent 700. It's acting as a terminal that you might, a VT100, that type of terminal, except you don't have a screen, and it's all on the paper. And so it is more functional than I would think. I mean, I know this is how terminals started, I think, some of the teletypes, but I was surprised at how able one is to use a VBS when you're just looking at this. And there's a sequence in the video that I'll leave for people to look at on their own, where, someone goes in and they're editing with a screen editor a misspelling on a different line, and that's where it gets a little bit hairy, actually. Yeah. Anyway, I was glad to see this in action again, or for the first time, rather, and I thought, since we, I'd mentioned it earlier, people might find it interesting.
It's a pretty interesting-looking little device, too.
Mm-hmm.
It looks very nice, compact, clean. It kind of has some of the aesthetic of, you know, TI in the end, their home computer turned that beige and had a certain kind of a similar shape to the original black and silver. This looks a little akin to that. I thought the design language is nice. It would be nice to have one. I think I'm going to probably have to track one down. And I guess some thermal paper, which is needed to see any output. I don't know how easily one can acquire 8.5 inch wide thermal paper these days, but I guess we'll find out.
It's possible, actually, that it isn't that hard. I mean, because it might still be used in receipts and stuff like that. Although 8.5 inch, I guess maybe not.
Yeah, well,
that's what I was thinking. It's the width of it will be hard.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned 8.5 inch. Yeah, I think that a lot of receipts are still using it, probably based on the quality. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think I've ever personally owned a thermal printer of any sort.
I never used a thermal printer in my actual life. Although I had, there's the Apple Silentype. Silentype, I think that's what it's called.
Yep.
It was such a printer.
No, the Scribe. Wasn't it the Scribe? It was the Silentype. The Silentype.
I think maybe both.
I think both.
The Silentype was the early old one. But just recently-ish, I had one. You know, like I acquired one in modern times. And just, I think a week or two ago, I connected it up to the Apple III and it worked. And it was quiet. It was amazingly quiet. I was surprised, actually, at, you know, just like, would just make this nice little printing.
So. Yeah, the video of this Silent 700, if you get in there and listen closely, I was shocked at how quiet this was, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually had I think the Scribe was similar to this. I had an OcuMate 20, and what it was it required a very smooth type of paper. I don't know if it was thermal paper, but it was a heat wax transfer. It had like a four color ribbon, the primary colors, and it would go across and it would melt the pixels that it printed onto the page. And you needed a special type of paper. I don't know if it was directly thermal, but I'm pretty sure that's what the Scribe had
for too, like here. Okay. Yeah, because that's the problem with thermal stuff. You don't see a lot of old thermal printouts because they just
they turn into
nothing. It's just like, here's a bunch of empty pages.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what I have for that's all I got for this week.
All right. Cool.
I got the next thing, and it's all visual, Paul. Suck it.
Yes. Awesome. Okay. Paint us a word picture.
This is so beautiful, though. So a person who goes by 6502B has made a miniature IBM 1401 data center, and it's a full-scale model. It's totally gorgeous.
Wow.
It looks like a photo of an actual data center until you see the giant hand reaching in to put a little – it's just stunning and beautiful. And unfortunately, if you're listening to the podcast, you don't really get to see much of it. But if you go to our show notes, you will see a link to a truly beautiful diorama, lovingly made of an old IBM data center. And it's just stunning. The details are crazily beautiful.
Yeah.
I am 100% in love with everything about it. It is just so gorgeous. The little tiny chairs, like, it's just great. So we're going to have a link to this diorama as well. And some of my favorite photos are when you look at it and it just looks like a photo. And then in the corner will be giant fingers just to show for scale. But just the detail of the wiring inside the computers and the paper coming out of the printer or being fed up into it, rather, is just amazing. And in addition to the link to it's on Imgur or Imgur, depending on how you want to pronounce it, is a set of these photos. We'll also have a link to this person's Instagram account so you can see even more photos of the making of it and behind the scenes stuff. Because it's just one of the most stunning model things I've ever seen. This person just does detail work that is unreal. Like, there's a photo of a card that just slides into one of the machines, and he's done all the little wire wraps on the back of it.
Yeah.
And it slid in, you wouldn't even see it. Just like the hidden details are unbelievable. One of the most stunning things I've seen in model making. Beautifully, lovingly done, and everybody should go take a look at it. So unfortunately, we're an audio podcast, so again, I'm doing everything in interpretive dance. but if you click the links, you will like it. You will be amazed at the beauty of this tiny, old-fashioned IBM world.
Yeah. Initially, I was doubly excited thinking that this was something he had created and was selling versions of, but as I saw the detail, it seems that that's, I guess, not the case. But it is striking.
No.
It is amazing.
Yeah. It's just so beautiful. I'm just absolutely in love with it.
And Carrington, what?
So that's it.
And when in doubt, Carrington, you want to go with that soft G, Imgur.
I normally do, yes.
Like I have a soft, doubt, G. Soft G.
I've usually heard Imgur.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes a lot more sense as a word. I've just always read it. So. Yeah. Okay, bingo cards out. My girlfriend, Canada, lives, etc., real person. Second mention, so bingo cards have already been checked. Pronounces GIF wrong. Like, I just only found that on the weekend. I'm like, what? She goes, oh, I don't really care. I'm like, I care a lot. So she's going to try to switch. It's not going to happen.
My coworkers.
The end of us.
Yeah. My coworkers. They're young.
So, anyway.
They're young.
Exactly. All the kids. Mm-hmm. If you weren't on coffee server at the time, as your reason, whatever. Don't fight me. Like, so... derailed into that again. Anyway, right. It's beautiful. Beautiful photos, and yes. Everyone should take a look.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
It actually reminds me a bit of the, you know, those sales models, right? That except this is like 10 times more detailed, but those things that the salespeople would carry around in the, you know, 60s or whatever to sell mainframes.
Right. We have a comment on our last piece. SSR guy says the thermal fax paper is still fairly easy to find on eBay.
Okay.
And Greg Yacht said that Quick Search says 8.5-inch thermal paper rolls, totally findable. So way to go, listeners.
Nice.
People are better at Google than us, or at least they tried.
Thank you, listeners.
Right. Oh, and R2 says that Brother manufactures thermal paper and rolls. Okay, everybody found this very easily and we're useless.
Very nice.
Okay, that's cool.
Very nice.
All right, let's see. I think I have the next thing. I actually came across this today. I have no idea if this is something that's been around forever or not, but this is the Virtual Colossus. You can find that at virtualcolossus.co.uk. We've definitely talked about Colossus.
Talk about it every time I can.
Yeah, and every time it's not that one, right? You know, this is the Colossus developed.
The real Colossus.
The name of a series of computers developed by British code breakers in 1943 to 1945 to help in crypt analysis of the Lorenz cipher.
And then went on to become the voice of world control.
That's right. Yeah. But so what this is, this actually is a little bit like that 8800, Altair 8800 in Unity, right? But it's basically a big simulation of a number of different possible machines. So the Colossus, the Virtual Lorenz SZ40 or SZ4042. And this allows you to kind of like run the machines yourself. So there are instructions. And I have not actually read the instructions or played with it at all.
So we wish you luck.
Yeah. There's like dials and knobs and there's a little printer and a display panel and everything. There are little pop-ups all over the place that will, you know, you can click, what is this? And it will tell you, you know, this is the display panel. The printer will tell you, oh, now I've got it. Now the printer's actually making noise in my ear. I think it is pretty cool, actually. If you really wanted to break some codes, it would actually allow you to do that probably in very slow time.
That's pretty slick.
Anyway, is this something either of you have seen before?
No.
I had not. That's kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah, absolutely amazing.
I actually don't even remember how I found it. So it must have been tweeted recently. So now that it's hard to go to any museums at all anyway, but even so, it was maybe hard to get your hands on one of these things. And this is actually could, if you were interested, give you an opportunity to really kind of experience what it was like to use a machine like this, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's this basic.
Cool.
Interesting. Anyway, find.
That was neat. So that's my item of interest and news.
Nice.
And I think Harrington has put in an extra one.
I just have a very small one because I wasn't sure if this is one we talked about from before or not. And it's a really quick mention. There's a neat article on solutionstreet.com, mm-hmm. Finding an Old Friend. Just about a guy who up in the attic or something found a bunch of cassette tapes, supposedly old audio things, mm-hmm. one of which turned out to be actually programs that he had written back in the 80s. And so then for his TRS-80 Model 1, mm-hmm. and then he used a audio software to bring it in and then load those audio waves into an emulator. And bingo, he suddenly has his old basic apps from the 1980s. And we've spoken about other similar things, but I don't think we actually did this one. Mm-hmm. And it was just a delightful little write-up of little games, horribly misspelled games that he wrote as a kid. Mm-hmm. And so if you like that kind of story, like feel-good stories about finding stuff that, that connects you to your old computer self, then it's a fun short read. It's back from May, but I want to link to it because it's actually a really good one. So if you like the old TRS-80 stuff, then this will bring back memories.
Nice.
Cool.
Nice.
And the only thing I would mention in the upcoming show roundup is that just recently, VCF Midwest, which would have been September 12th to 13th, has decided to be canceled. And VCF Midwest, we, for some reason, that kept not making it into our show notes. So we kept not mentioning it. Now we are mentioning it as they are canceled. But it is one of the bigger VCF shows. So next time when it happens, we'll talk about it. Anyway, okay, I think we can leave it at that. And now, a word from our sponsor.
A typical card system user had key punches, verifiers, collators, sorters, reproducing punches, accumulating reproducers, interpreters, accounting machines, and a calculator with attached punch and storage units. Upon the introduction of the 1401 tape system, much of this equipment was no longer required. The former card system carried with it 46 drawers of advance cards, 23 drawers of accounts receivable, and 32 drawers of name and address cards, which the 1401 replaced with less than one rack of magnetic tape. The reduction of procedural steps is equally dramatic. Customer billing on the old card-based equipment involved 21 separate machine passes to produce the customer bill, the new advance card, and revenue analysis. The 1401 system did the same jobs in just 7 machine steps.
And we're back. So the host's retrocomputing gift idea is actually one that was foreshadowed before as having been emailed to us by Bob. So this is the Color Maximite 2. So what it is a small self-contained computer inspired by home computers of the early 80s, such as the TRS-80, Commodore 64, Apple II. It's got an ARM, 32-bit RISC processor running at 480 megahertz. Generating a VGA output, otherwise it's kind of like a little basic computer. You know, so you start it up, you get a basic command line. You now have basic at a sort of high enough power that it can write things like Castle Wolfenstein and Tetris and what was it? Gauntlet, I think, was one of the example things where, you know, it's like the Gauntlet game written in BASIC.
Yep, because mm-hmm. it handles, it's a 64-bit BASIC with floating point and long variable names and arrays with multiple DIMMs and like just like, so it's like a super BASIC, it seems. Mm-hmm. It's going to soon be on the Tobii index as the number 7 is going to bump out Microsoft Visual BASIC and be like, yeah, Maximite BASIC for the win.
So this is I think maybe even the third iteration of this platform. So there was the Maximite, which was black and white, and the Color Maximite, which introduced color. And this is now the Color Maximite 2, which now has 65,000 colors, right?
Cool. Do you know what the screen resolution is that it pumps out?
It says 800 by 600.
Oh, wow. So that's totally usable.
So
nice.
It's pretty reasonable.
It's almost too much.
This exists as a kit. You can, and in fact, actually, it exists as a description. You know, so you can print your own board. You can get your own components. You could, you know, there's various ways that you can put this thing together, or you can get it prefabricated, which is what I am most interested in doing. You can get it fabricated in a number of different places. There are places, so Circuit Gizmos in the USA, Micromite.org in the UK. There's Mick Gulveson in Australia is doing them. Rick Tech in New Zealand is doing them. And so if you go to the USA one, Circuit Gizmos, they're selling it for $99. That's just the board. So it doesn't come, the enclosure for it is not included in that, but you can get an enclosure. So they have a little link to Newark where you can get a project enclosure that would work for this. Not currently stocked, it says. But at any rate, $99 is not crazy expensive.
Now, for a lot of people, if as an introduction to like a small computer, if you felt as your retro computer enthusiast that something like an Arduino or like a Raspberry Pi is a little intimidating, you're like, I don't want to learn Unix, I don't want to or Linux or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like something like this that just boots instantly to a version of BASIC, this could be a nice like how about you start with one of these?
Yeah.
What I really like is I was worried about the power supply on this thing. You get the one like we're I have a link to the one from the UK. Mm-hmm. But it just runs off a 5-volt USB.
Yeah.
Like,
well, that's handy.
The 8-bit guy, he did a – did you mention this? He did a demo of this 1 week ago on his YouTube channel.
Oh, no. Yeah, there's a couple. The 8-bit guy did one, and that follows up on one that someone else did.
He had earlier done the 8-bit or the Color Mac. He'd done – I guess there's like two or three in the past. Like there was the Maximite, which was much less powerful, and then he reviewed – just very recently this Color Maximite 2, and he talks about some of the older screen resolutions that the original had. This one still supports in legacy, and there's a BASIC command that you can enter that tells it to dumb itself down to maybe run the old code. Anyway, that's also worth a watch. That's probably the same link in that you pointed to in that document. I just happened to run across it.
Yeah, I mean, if you were wondering kind of what it could do, there's two. So there's this debug live video, which is basically the guy getting the kit and building it. So you can sort of see the build process as well, and then some of the stuff you can make with it. So there's some demo code and things like that, and it's pretty powerful. I mean, I believe Gauntlet was one of the kind of like demo things, but I mean, it just looks like the arcade.
Yeah, there's some demo scene productions. I think that's going to pop. Yeah, the demo scene productions that are like running in BASIC, which you know look pretty good, despite that they're running in BASIC.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool. This has great appeal to me.
Yep. And this, but you know, in a sense, this also does seem like exactly that. Question of like, do you program it more efficiently or do you just throw more hardware at it? We're going to program in BASIC at 480 megahertz.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, I think it's kind of cool. It's not super expensive. It's you know, it might be a nice thing to do while you're stuck at home.
That's a great gift idea. Yeah. Yep, I dig it.
Certainly.
And once you're done buying that, we now have many eBay auctions to talk about. Maybe we won't talk about all of them. Who knows? But, okay, so on to the eBay auctions, and Blake has the first few.
Okay, so the first item on my eBay list is an Apple One again. I don't think we had talked about this one that appeared.
I think we mentioned it, like, not the week it was on.
Oh.
But, like, later saying, I can't believe we didn't even bother mentioning that there was an Apple One on eBay.
Oh,
is it,
okay.
Is it a real one?
It appeared, well, they're asking $1,500,000 for it, so I'm guessing it is.
You're hoping it is.
Yeah, the description, fully functional working condition, original bite shop wood case, not a replica. Museum collectors, mm-hmm. enthusiasts have been waiting for this to be for sale. Anyway, yeah.
And they've been waiting to pay eBay 10% of the fees.
Right, yeah. Right. eBay is the excellent way to sell such a unit. So the description talks about, you know, some of the version of keyboard it has, power supply, that kind of thing. It's this particular Apple One was seen in number 75 of the Apple One registry. So yes, it appears to be legit. I can't imagine why someone would sell this on eBay, you know, versus, you know, Christie's or some other route. But you know, what do you say? It's only $1 shipping. So that's good, at least to me.
I'm sure what that means is they'll throw it in a box with a free can of Coke and send it off to you.
Yeah, so anyway, another Apple One, you know, coming from Florida, Boca Raton. And that's all, you know, there it is. That's the Apple One. Mm-hmm. On to the next one. I just thought this was interesting. True Vision Target 32 Isobus video graphics processing card. AT&T had something to do with this. So yeah, I see there's an AT&T sticker. Anyway, the reason I mention this, it's one of the early back, you know, before we had even Amiga type colors, for the PC, the only way you got, you know, television level true color was, Targa was the main, I believe the main, PC option, as far as a frame buffer that software could render to. I remember the TGA files, you know, no one had these. This wasn't a consumer device. But the board is impressive to look at. It's just rife with VRAM chips. It's a long, full-length ISA card. And I don't think I'd ever seen. I you hear about Targa. You've seen book pictures, computer graphics Targa, but I'd never actually seen a board. And so I just thought I'd mention it in case there are others that remember that, you know, Targa was kind of the superpower in graphics in the early 80s for true color. I don't even know what the resolution is. It's probably 640 by 480 at most. But
that's enough.
Yeah, but it's...
I mean, Micromite is bigger, but...
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. This is $292.
Maximite.
That was the Maximite.
Still in it. Maximite.
Yeah, so there it is. $292 if anyone wants to put it in there. $5150. And yeah. So, anyone here dealt with Targa hardware?
No, not at all.
And then here's my next item. I'm just moving through quickly. I don't know what this is, and that's why I'm mentioning it. I spent some time looking online, and I seem to at least always have one curiosity that no one, I haven't been able to find info on, so I'll keep with that tradition. It says Rare Olympus America DS1 300-01 floppy disk computing device video. It's got a floppy disk in the front, little some buttons, start
party in the back
menu, yeah. aux remote, S video, power, looks like a serial connection, and then you've got in the back BNC outs, S video out, BNC in, perhaps another serial port. I wonder what this is. It sounds like it could be you've got images on a floppy, or you're putting images on a floppy, digitizing them. I thought there was a very off chance somebody might know what this is, but I spent about 20 minutes on Google and I couldn't find one reference to it. That's right. Aged.
So I will not do that myself then.
Being Olympus, I wonder if this is a thing for a bunch of cameras came out. Did Olympus have a disc camera the way Sony did?
I couldn't. I looked for that. I didn't see a consumer floppy camera from Olympus. But
so I wonder if this was a thing that let you... My guess is you put a disc camera in this and then it lets you print like to film.
Maybe. It doesn't look very consumer. Like, you know, the enclosure, it definitely looks... is, you know, there's not a lot of thought put into making a...
But I definitely have no idea. So we'll see if...
Maybe somebody out there...
If somebody in the comments right now knows what it is.
Right in. I just thought it caught my eye.
Also, Olympus just left the camera business, by the way.
Did they?
Yeah, I think of Olympus as a camera company, but as of...
That's why they're selling this thing.
As of, you know, June 24th, they have announced they're done. After 84 years.
Oh, it looks like they also make binoculars. They're going to double down on binoculars. Cool. Yep, they do binoculars and handheld field recorders.
I thought I had remembered this coming up recently that, like, you know, major names in the camera world were disappearing.
I could see that. I mean, who? It's just the phone you have on you is your camera nowadays.
Like,
good enough is good enough.
So they weren't an American company? I felt like I counted them among like Heathkit and some of the Zenith that were some of the few. Interesting. And now you mentioned the binoculars. It may be, I think we actually did have, I grew up on a river and my father was big into binoculars to, you know, look at the boats out there. And yeah, I think we actually had a pair of heavy duty Olympus binoculars.
Yeah. Google tells me that it was founded in Tokyo, Japan, October 12th, 1919.
Okay. Well,
wow. That is a long time.
I've lived a lie all this time. okay.
Yeah. So Greg in the chat suggests that there is more than one Olympus, so that is also possible. We may be conflating companies, but
okay.
And also thinks that possibly this device is some kind of a video titler.
That was my second. First thought until I saw it was Olympus thing is some form of video titler. Yeah, except that those normally will have a plugin for a keyboard to enter titles, but maybe, I don't know, weird.
Maybe you did that elsewhere, and this was the player. Yeah.
Who knows?
Had a remote. It
Let's fumble around and take guesses.
Yeah.
So you don't think the stir and fruise buttons give us some sort of a hint?
Yeah, didn't do much for me. But on to the next one. This is my last item, I believe. And this is something that I think you can't get any longer just through a straight purchase. What it is, it's an Inside Next book. And it says, Detail Steve Jobs, Next Computer Software, Cube, Peripherals, Apple. Very taggy title. It's a book by Luciano Dada, who, and I don't know if this was mentioned some years ago on the show or not, but he put together, he's involved in a user group in Italy, and he put together this very lovely, some years ago, book with very professional looking photographs of Next hardware. You know, the nice. Next Cube, all the variants of the cubes. He acquired the hardware, like, either through group members, you know, cleaned everything up. The shots are beautiful. You see these motherboard shots. He labels them, describes everything that's going on for a whole range of hardware, and some of the angles, the pictures are great. It was Italian. It was done in Italian. There was only a run of about 100 books. And I remember I contacted him at the time saying, well, I'd be interested, you know, are you selling overseas? And he said, well, do you speak Italian? I said, no. He said, well, what good would that do you? And, you know, I said, well, yes, that's true, but pretty pictures. At any rate, he ended up coming out with an English version. I think he did another run. This time it was 150 or so. And I'd heard that they all sold. And they were, I don't recall what the price was. I mean, it wasn't ridiculous. It wasn't insane. It's a nice quality bound book. But he, in the process, after the initial contact, he actually reached out about an image. I have the book, the English version of the book. And in the processing, he actually used one of my own Next Station images that I had taken and put on Flickr as a full page. So I have a particular fondness of this item. Mm-hmm. But aside from the fact that, you know, my Next Station is pictured from some years ago, it's an amazing coffee table style book, and right now it's actually on the shelf in my office, which I haven't seen in some months. But yeah, so here this auction is looking at. It looks like this person. It doesn't appear to be the author, and it looks like there's four available. There were six sold, and I do recall hearing very quickly that they had sold out. So if they're going for $80. You know, there's no indication for condition.
Well, it says that they're signed, so.
So they're okay. They're signed.
Yeah.
I assume they're new. Limited run, yes, certainly limited run, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess they're new. It doesn't say that they're used books, whatever that means. But yeah, so $80 with free shipping, at least to me, from Colorado. It's a very good book. It's one of this sort of pictorial, technical, of those that I have on my shelf. I'd count this, you know, in the top five easily. It's a nice. Beautiful
book. And this book seems to have come down hard on the Next is always spelled with capital N, small e, capital X, capital T. Even when there's all uppercase sentences, it's a lowercase e, and that's it. But Next Station, for instance, lowercase s.
There you go. So yeah, if
this book has opinions.
If you want to have your field guide to how to write the various Next softwares and hardware technologies, you want to have this with you. And then you'll be set. But anyway, nice. I thought it was nice to see an opportunity to get a few more if anyone is looking. But that's all I have for the eBay auctions for this month.
Cool.
I think that the seller, this may be the Black Hole Hardware people.
Computer Powwow?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Look, Black Hole Inc. Okay.
So this is like the premier seller of Next stuff in the modern day.
Right. I have bought hardware from Black Hole Inc. probably 20 years ago. Yeah, they've been around for a while.
Yeah. All right. Carrington, you must be next, right?
I am next indeed. And my first item, just like my last article was about finding an old friend, long-time listeners to the podcast will know that the way I want to make friends, follows where I go with this, is I bring labeled bags to the grocery store, and then people will look at the bag and say, oh, you got a Beagle Brothers bag. I want to be your friend. This has not worked for me so far, but I might be able to up my game, and you could up your game if you bought this lovely Mac Week cloth bag. A lot of bags that are computer-related on eBay. Often it's bags for, like, lugging around actual computers. This is one of those. This is not, like, for a laptop or whatever. This is simply a Go Shopping bag. With the MacWeek logo in red and white on one side and the MacWeek logo in white and red on the other side. So basically, same thing. I fondly remember MacWeek. I like the magazine very much. It's a nice looking bag, kind of a vertical orientation. So maybe it's supposed to be filled with a bunch of liquor bottles. I don't know. I think this plus Beagle Brothers is going to make me friends. It's only $9.99 starting bid. Nobody's bid yet. Nobody wants to be my friend. So 2 days from now, you could scoop up a friend for the cheap, low, low price of $10. I think it would be money well spent, is what I say.
Excellent.
I think it's a nice looking bag. So that's it. Just wanted to get people friends. Friends through bags. That's my motto, baby. My second item is a word processor, which caught my eye because it's for the Apple II and the Apple III. It's the Gutenberg. But mostly caught my eye because the little sticker in the corner,
I like it.
Made in Canada. All the best stuff is made in Canada, like me, baby. I don't know this word processor, but I suspect Paul does. Paul, tell me about this word processor.
I don't know much about
it. Do you know the Gutenberg?
I have come across it before. I think I actually have a disk for it.
Because it's amazing the stuff it can do, mathematical equations and things. Like for the Apple II and Apple III word processor, I'm surprised that it can do graphics incorporated into it and weird non-English symbols. And non-English doesn't mean weird. That's not what I meant. Yeah. I meant weird symbols and also non-English characters. And that it can do interesting programming stuff for import, it says, and proportional type. And just I'm surprised at what it can do. Maybe it thinks. I don't know. But it's made in Canada, so it's got to be good. Probably smells of
maple syrup.
And bear. So maybe that's good. Maybe it's bad. I don't know. It is $100. Buy it now. Paul will buy it and use it and tell us all about it, won't you, Paul?
That's interesting. I'm pretty sure that I got – but I think I picked up these discs. Not the manual.
But not the box?
The discs from Kansas Fest, which means, you know, they were imaged in the corner and then I remember them because they have these gold foil labels. You can sort of see them in the auction picture. But they're actually pretty hard to photograph because they're just like mirrors.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
But I also have a disc called Gutenberg Senior. So there was a
the better version.
Even more updated one.
Don't settle for this thing. What I like about the inside the manual, it's got this picture with a sketch of Johannes Gutenberg with a speech bubble and his name all written out in text. And it says everything in this manual was produced solely and completely on my word processor. So it's a word processor that can do this. And most of the word processors I used on the Apple II could not have done this. So I'm pretty surprised at what it can do.
This looks really good.
Wow. You should buy it.
I want to. I don't know if it, maybe. I don't know. How expensive is it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Pull the trigger.
Okay.
It's $100 and you're going to do it right now, baby. Nobody can travel anywhere. You think of it as your travel budget.
Right.
You're going to put it towards Gutenberg.
It explicitly says it works on the Apple III. So, you know. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, and more importantly, it explicitly says made in Canada. Think of that lovely Canadian feeling you'll have. You come up to Canada all the time.
That's right.
Exactly. Remind you of those lovely trips. Anyway, that's my second choice, Gutenberg or the Gutenberg for Apple II and Apple III. And my third one is Cyborg. $130 for a piece of Apple II software. Why would anybody want to pay that? Probably not. But Cyborg is an interesting game. Do you guys know this game at all?
I don't think.
Okay, so it's a Mike Berlin game. So he's kind of better known as the guy behind Utopos, which was also by Sentinel Software or Sentinel Software, and then went on and did some stuff for Infocom. And so, like, he's the name behind it. This is the Apple II version, and it's still sealed. So $130 Cyborg is not a bad, if you collect the stuff, a still sealed version of this, that's not a bad price. It's it's an interesting, I haven't even played it. So it's an interesting looking text adventure game by a guy who's got a name in text adventures. So that makes it neat. But what I like about this, the thing that always stands out whenever I see a copy of Cyborg, is there was an interview once with Mike Berlin talking about the games he made in the past. And so Zen and Software put this out for the Apple II, for I think the Atari, a few different things, including IBM PC. So he's asked about the IBM PC version of this game. And he said, well, no, it never came out for the IBM PC. He had no idea. Behind the scenes, somehow, they ported and released a version of his game that he didn't even know about. And it is famously buggy. Mm-hmm. It's the IBM PC version, but it will not run on an IBM PC. Because it was clearly made on some knockoff IBM that had a weird BIOS, and it will only run on that. So oh, if you run it on an official, it's the official software, but it will not run on an official IBM. It is not compatible. It's only compatible with one particular compatible that is like 5% of the IBMs at the time. It's like really niche, super buggy, bizarre that it got released by the same brand, and the author of the game was like, no, it got ported to a few things. I guess he didn't get royalties on that one. So it has kind of a shady past. So every time I see it, I remember that article where he was surprised to hear about the super buggy version of his game. So there you go. That's Cyborg. $130, but still sealed. Mm-hmm. And the version you really want to get that would be super collectible is that bizarrely buggy IBM version.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which you only want for the story you can't play it.
I don't know if the story. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I would rip this sucker open in a heartbeat, but is what it is. But you can't. You could play it. What if you've got that particular IBM knockoff? Mm-hmm. I don't even remember what the clone is, but if you've got that clone, it'd be a game like perfect for you. This isn't that game. This is the Apple II version. I only took because I wanted to bring up the story for the other version. Yeah, that's what I got. Those are my choices. IBM will buy them all, or IBM. Paul will buy them all. Right. Your new name is IBM.
The this is one of these ones. I don't actually know what the story is behind these, but it's shipping from Venezuela.
I think I've bought stuff from this person then.
Right.
Is this the person who has all those big box versions of software?
Well, I think there must be a few such people in Venezuela. But Venezuela is a good source for I don't understand exactly how it is that, you know, like I guess a bunch of maybe there was about to be a big Apple II market in Venezuela that fizzled or something, but and then things got stuck in warehouses and just left. But so this seller does have quite a number of, you know, sort of interesting unopened Apple II software.
But these weird, yeah. So this is someone that always has those weird big box versions of relatively obscure Apple II games, and by the hundreds, it seems. So maybe there's about to be a flood of sealed copies of Cyborg, in which case $130 is too much to pay because this seller might have 300 of them.
Yeah, I think, at least for us in the US, it's a little bit, you know, it costs a lot to get it from there. So you wind up...
But it's free shipping to me.
Well, right, but it's $120 or whatever, right?
Well, yeah, but once you pay your $130, it's free after that.
Yeah.
That's how healthcare works in Canada, too. That's why we call it free healthcare. We pay all that tax, but then it feels like free when you get it. Right. It's great. Yeah. It's a bargain. Can't afford not to get it. I love it. Actually, I do love our healthcare, so there, suck it.
There is actually one – I'm looking in the other auctions from the seller, and there is one where there's actually sort of like six games put together for $450 where, you know, you can pay the shipping all at once.
Oh, it includes one of these?
It does include Cyborg. It also includes a couple of a few Piccadilly.
So there's going to be a run on the Cyborg market, I think. So don't invest. In fact, I might short Cyborg. Is there possible to short things on eBay? Anyway, it's got a good story about the IBM version. So that's really why I mentioned it.
I like it.
Nice.
So that's all I got.
All right. Let's see. I have
17,000 things.
I will try to move quickly here. Okay. So the first thing I have is a Popular Electronics, I think January and February 1975. And so I actually have a search on for this.
For this particular issue?
Yeah, exactly. Because this is... January 1975 is the issue that had the fake Altair 8800 on the cover.
So this is that one.
Yeah. So it had an article about the 8800. I think, if I remember right, the story behind this was that the actual 8800 that they wanted to take a picture of got, like, lost in transit or something like that.
And yeah, I think they shipped it and it never arrived or something.
Yeah. So,
what, did they just make one out of, like, paper or something?
It's some kind of mock-up, yeah, because it doesn't actually look like what the thing does, looks like. Anyway, this is a fairly sought-after issue of this magazine. So I almost never see it at any kind of a reasonable price. Right now, this one is being bid on, and it is currently at $46 after two bids. And, you know, you get a bonus February issue with it, but no one cares about that.
Oh, poor February issue.
Yeah. So anyway, if you're interested, I have never been interested to the level that these things sell at, but I'm just pointing it out. If you also want to join in the search, it's January 1975, Popular Electronics.
I recall it, that issue, that cover being held up in Pirates of Silicon Valley, the movie, in the dorm room.
Ah, okay, cool. By the way, actually, just to continue on a little bit with the previous topic, Sorcerer Guy in our chat mentioned having bought an unopened box of six VIC-20 cartridges from one of these, you know, Venezuelan warehouses and found that they all had bad ROMs. This could have been due to customs. It could also have been like they were defective from the outset. Who knows?
Old ROMs or something? I know the software that I got, the Apple II, all was fine.
Yeah. And I know that there was one thing that I got where it was in sort of like a nice, one of those sort of like padded binders, but it had been sliced open. Because customs thought maybe someone was shipping me drugs or something. I don't know.
Because who would actually buy this thing? They didn't believe this the description.
And I think that someone else had said something somewhere about a jump man or something that had come that where, you know, the box had been sliced open.
So you're saying if I get a job with the U.S. Customs Border Patrol, I can release the 80s air on its way to other people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I think I found my calling. So we open other people's software.
Yeah, I mean, that's always kind of a danger with just sending things over a border, basically.
Sure.
But so I'm a little hesitant to get things. If I want to get something specifically because it's still sealed and I want to be able to scan it, you know, with whatever particles of the 80s air are still left on it, then I will think twice, I guess, about that. I mean, they're available, but it's a risk.
That's a good point, because if somebody buys something sealed, it's either because they want to collect it as a sealed item, and that's part of the value in it to them or to the market, or because they want the experience of opening up the new thing. Like that's a fun thing too. But in either case, you've bought it and paid more to get it sealed because you want it to arrive sealed.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it would be very disappointing, I guess, to get it and have it be opened up by customers.
It would be.
And actually one third reason, which is one of the reasons I often aim for sealed is that, you have the best chance of a pristine thing to scan, you know.
Right. Good point.
So
not been written in or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So that's that.
You have something that's to remind us of our mortality. Is the second one what?
So this is three Commodore Executive SX64s. These things are. I think we're probably mostly aware of what these are. These are the kind of portable Commodore 64s. They're pretty cool, actually. I mean, they're particularly cool when you see them on and they have just like the little like regular Commodore stuff going on in that little window.
In that little tiny screen.
Yeah.
Although I still can never get behind the tiny screen luggable computers. But
yeah.
I do agree that it's one of the cooler ones of those, though, because it always looks like, did you build a Commodore 64 in an Osborne? Like, I don't understand what's happening.
It's a pretty sharp screen given its color. And you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that I think is maybe one of the things that makes it most impressive is that it's color. You know, like you don't expect something in this form factor to have a color display.
Right.
And so it's an SX64. I think the S stands for single, and the SX64 I think is the only one that really kind of got out there in any numbers. So they all have this kind of glove compartment where it's like this empty bay that you can like stick junk in above the disk drive.
Yeah, above the disk drive. Yeah.
I think the DX64 might exist in like a couple of prototypes or maybe just a couple of things that actually got out, the D for dual or double, but which actually has disk drives in both of those spots.
I don't think it was ever sold publicly.
Yeah, that was my thinking too. Earl probably knows. But anyway, so what this is three SX64s in kind of varying condition. One of them, I think, or one lacks their handles and one lacks the top or something like that. But anyway, the reason in our own show notes, I wrote a comment about how it reminds us of our mortality, because it's basically, this is like someone's father's thing who passed away. And this is an offspring who knows nothing about it, hasn't tested any of the stuff. You know, this is what they know. They have these three SX64s. They're pretty collectible things, actually. I mean, like these are things that people want. So this is actually kind of a find, but this is also the future. You know, it's going to be, yes, it's going to be people who don't really know this stuff, going through whatever stuff there is in the attic or the shed or, you know, the storage space or whatever. So I don't know. I don't know how it's going to do. I mean, like, I think that individually these things are usually in the, like, middle hundreds, I would say, probably like 100, 130, 150 or something is what you might expect to pay for one. So I don't know how big it's going to go, how high it will go with three in sort of partial condition.
Yeah, because it kind of looks like this, like a good one and two parts machines or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can see a collector getting that kind of stuff. And also the photos all show them on a rack. Huh. And you can see other little things above and below and beside it. So it's clearly this is somebody's big racked, not racked like a server rack, but just like shelves of a collection. And so I suspect this is a person who's inherited many shelves of probably lovingly collected retro computer things, all of which are now going to get dumped on eBay because, you know, our families don't want our stuff.
Yeah, right. And they sure don't want to hear any more about the ARM transition.
And yet, they will.
I saw
if I have anything to do with it.
I noticed some, so I could see some CRTs on the upper shelves in the pictures you were showing.
Yep.
So I couldn't make out any other, Oh, and a Dell tower.
So I think I don't think there's anything else in the other items now, but I think there will be. Mm. So.
Yeah, it's kind of, most people who collect this thing, there might be a bunch of related things or whatever. So it might be a seller to watch because they're going to come up with some things. So it also feels kind of.
Yeah, that feels kind of.
Picking over
that,
some
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, that feels sort of dark. Ghoulish. Yeah, let's see what jail she finds in her father's lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a strange line to walk because you want to get a good deal if you can get a good deal. You want things to go into the hands of someone who cares about it. So if you care about it, your hands are good hands.
Yeah.
You know.
But I'm sure whoever collected this would prefer them to be in the hands of a collector and cared for versus just trashed.
Right. But at the same time, there is this kind of tension because you want to jump on it if you have a chance to get something that you wouldn't normally be able to afford. At the same time, it's a little unfair.
Yeah.
Yep. And these aren't the kind of things that somebody can just have a garage sale / yard sale / whatever they say in your area and put them all up because someone will come up and say, okay, I'll give you $2 for those old things or whatever. Yeah. So it is more sensible if you are the person who inherits these things to stick them up on eBay and let the greater population just bid on stuff.
Yeah,
it felt a little strange over, I guess it was the holiday, not this past holiday season, but the one before. I would been talking with Benj, Edwards, he has a Tandy HX system, and I got excited about the notion of getting one of these compact things, and I looked on Craigs, and someone, of all places in the country, someone like right in my city was selling a 1000 HX system. It was like disk drives, monitor, printer, stand for like $101, which is a very good price, you know, for everything and like really good condition. And she said her father had gone into assisted living community and he, you know, they had to, so she was clearing out like his house and she met me at the post office and we did the thing and it was, you know, it definitely had a weird, I was glad, clearly I was, you know, I set it up, I used it. I actually sent her a note saying, you know, with a picture of it. I was like, I don't know if your father cares, but like, here it is online, you know, like I'm just, it's in use, but yeah, it's got that strange feel about it. And it also has a strange feel of your own self looking towards the future, as you point out, in a dark and macabre way, Paul. Yeah.
I mean, it's come up a couple of times where, you know, someone we kind of know from the community passes away and then suddenly like, you know, all those things that they were posting on the boards about show up on eBay, you know, which is just a little weird, you know.
Yeah.
when you see something come up on eBay and you're saying, oh, I wonder what this thing is, and you search Google and you find that person describing it and, you know, talking about this exact thing that's now for sale.
Bringing me down, thanks, Paul. Yeah.
Okay. The next thing, this I don't need to talk about very much. It's just it is a assembled Alt-Arduino.
So it's another fake Altair. You're just full of fake Altair.
That's right. Because all the real ones went to Earl. which he has yet to talk about, but I predict that in the future he will talk about getting Altairs.
Oh, yes. I guess other people don't know that. Yes, got a bunch of Altairs.
But yeah, so this is actually the person who makes the kits. And yeah, I saw these in kit form on my website, but is having some trouble getting parts and stuff, and still had a couple sort of assembled ones. So this is basically from the person who created it. You know, so there's that kind of legitimacy to it. It's little. I mean, you know, it's just the front panel.
Mm.
But it looks nice. It looks very cool. And it's not a lot at $190. I mean, it's a lot by some measures, I suppose. But I am so tempted. I have a PyDP8 kit that I got a long time ago, which is like a PDP8 run by a Raspberry Pi. And I'm never going to get around to assembling the dumb thing. I mean, I really want to see it working, but it's going to take, you know, 3 days to put it together. So it's kind of neat.
That's cool.
I like the way these look. The next thing I have is, it's called a magnifier for the 9-inch Macintosh. And what it is it's like a Fresnel lens, I think, that you put on the front of your 9-inch Mac to like make it so that you can see it bigger.
And I 100% get your reference to EarIMJH.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I love that movie. I absolutely love that movie. So, yep. In our show notes, Paul has written EarIMJH. So those of you who know the movie Brazil will know what he's talking about.
This is...
I frequently say that in my mind. Like, I'm all the time. I'm seeing a password. I'm in an elevator and I'm like, EarIMJH. It's weirdly stuck to me.
It is funny how
that... I'm like, oh my gosh. Yeah. It took me forever to realize it's Jeremiah anagrammed. Because when I watched the movie the first time, I'm like, what the heck is EarIMJH? Like, I don't get it as a
it
password.
It feels like it should be meaningful, and yet...
Yeah. Anyway, there's a side road down. I could talk about Brazil for a while, but I was like, oh, that just get out of my head.
Yeah. I think it would be very cool to have a Fresnel lens on an arm. You know, that you stuck in front of your Osborne or whatever. But in fact, I think there is a magnifier kind of like that for the Osborne, the OCC1. I'm pretty sure I've seen that. But I had not seen this magnifier.
I would assume there was. Right.
I mean, if there's one for anything, you'd hope there'd be one for the Osborne.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I haven't seen this one before either. We've talked previously about that other thing that goes in front and makes it look like there's a hologram and stuff in front of me for sketching, for drawing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had not seen this magnifier before.
Wait a minute.
At least I don't think so.
Wait, it says up to 250% enlargement. How is that possible?
If you go step back from the computer, just keep bringing the lens over, I guess.
Like use the actual stretchiness of the keyboard cord.
You'd have to pan it. Well,
but no, it'll never be bigger than
it's not going to get bigger
display,
than itself.
But if you make the computer farther away,
then you can
make it be on the horizon and be a dot. It's like 10,000 times. And then you redo it and see. Come on, we talked about this earlier.
Well, they need to come. They need to have a helmet that has like four like poles that you can mount it to the front of your face.
You keep telling me I need to have a helmet.
You know, just sit there and look around, and you know, that get your 250% worth.
Excellent. Sounds like a good investment. Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's a pretty funny thing that I had not come across before. Starting bid is $150. The ad I just brought up, by the way, I have a link to an ad in I forget where the ad is, but and it sold for $30 initially, so it's good return on investment there.
Excellent. So there are some retro things you can buy.
Yeah.
That were worth buying. Excellent. That's one. Turns out the magnifier was the best investment in the 80s. Yeah. About 1,000 of those instead of Apple sock. Hopefully I've done well.
Next thing I have is it's called an XU1541 Nano, which is one version of some, you know, something that exists in several different kinds of versions. But it is essentially, it took me a second to figure out what it was, but it's essentially a way to plug in your Commodore 1541 drive to a USB port. So it's a way to like on your MacBook Pro have a 1541 drive connected to it. It has, you know, so on one end it's a little like modern USB, and then on the other side it's the big, you know, DIN connector that you connect up to your Commodore 64 drive. And so what I think this, you know, I think this is basically for like imaging Commodore disks on a modern machine. You know, like you can get a sort of like a file system.
Really? Yeah, surely it's their software, right? Because
OpenCBM, yeah.
Okay, so there's some kind of software that works with it that lets you read the disk, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it, yeah.
So I assume this is largely for archival purposes or whatever. I don't think it's capable of doing the kind of like flux stuff that like the applesauce and the cryoflux and things like that do, or the, I forget all the other ones. There's a number of them.
Yeah. The applesauce was the one that came to mind for me. Yeah.
So applesauce is a little bit like this in that it's a way to connect a Apple II, you know, floppy drive to a modern Mac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Over USB. Yeah.
So, and I have one right next to me, in fact. But it's the same kind of thing. It's basically you're connecting the Nano for the Commodores. You're connecting an actual physical Commodore drive to your modern machine, and the applesauce is you're connecting an actual Apple II drive to your modern machine. No Apple IIs or Commodores required.
Right.
So, and it's kind of interesting. It's $30, and this too is being sold by the person who fabricated it. Although it's based on a somewhat open source, I think, design. So I don't need to talk about this next one very much. It's a Geneva PX8, which we love to talk about.
Yes, indeed.
So Carrington doesn't understand why people like these, right?
Not particularly. Yeah, I'm not super against them. Yeah. It's more the Osborne type things I don't understand. I think we've spoken about these more often than the number that sold originally, though. Yeah. So we could have spoken to each person who bought one individually. We could have podcasted, because boy, howdy, do we talk about these things, and they are not that exciting.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, they're just little CPM machines. This one is nice, partly because it has.
Yeah. Well, tell me why is this a good one?
This particular
always, one. You guys always have a reason why it's a particularly good one to talk about. What's good about this one?
This particular one has multi-unit 64 on it, which is extra RAM, and I think it has another, might have a couple extra slots, and it gives it some extra connections in the back. And it has a little bag and a keyboard protector. And you know, it's basically relatively complete.
Yeah, and the keyboard's really clean. I love the look of the keyboards on these.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But every time I look at them from the side, these, I always think they look like they weigh 30 pounds.
No, they aren't actually too heavy.
Okay.
Having this extra pack on the back makes it a little heavier, but
yeah.
And is the display on these easy to see in crappy light or not?
It's not bad. The view angle slider is actually I think it's actually a contrast slider, really.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty novel to me to have a CPM laptop. It's the only CPM machine I have in the house. Well, actually, I have a Tandy Model 4, which I guess can run.
Anyway, it's pretty cheap too. So to me in Boston, shipping from Texas, it's $60, but the starting bid is $1. So, if you happen to be looking for these, I think one of the things I really like the most about it is the keyboard. It's just, there's something just like wonderful about the coloring of the keyboard.
Yeah. But, it's pretty nice. Yeah. Earl forced me to buy one of these.
And it has the little microcassette in.
Yeah. The microcassette.
Okay. This one I think is pretty cool. I wrote in the show notes that I might actually just buy this on air, but this is a personal portable computer, 16 BC Dynasty model. And what it is basically it's an abacus with a little like software programs for the 16 BC Dynasty model personal portable computer pamphlet. And it's basically just a little ridiculous joke.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The world's first low-tech computer. Yeah. No batteries. 91 beads or bits. Nice.
Yeah. This one is. Oh, actually, you can actually see the little sticker on it. Since we're talking about returns on investment, this person bought it for $30. You can buy it now for $20.
Oh. So. Yeah, but they got probably maybe many years of use out of it for just $10. Yeah,
that's not bad.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought it was kind of cool. It's not too expensive. It's also not. I mean, you know, it's a joke. It will probably not age all that well.
I should get it for my daughter. She'd enjoy that as a joke. Yeah. I'm sure.
Okay. Well, there it is.
Yeah.
See, that sounds like the kind of thing a father thinks that their daughter would enjoy.
It does sound
their daughter's like, thanks, Dad, and never touched it.
There was a slight bit of sarcasm in my voice there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Just a slight.
Because I was going to say, I don't think.
I'll say, well, I was going to get you the Intel version, but this is actually an ARM-based unit. And
yes, it's your ARM is used.
Right. Yeah. There's a transition.
Apple's
period.
Switching architectures, right. And the next one will be just abacus based.
We got it. They changed the A in arms. They changed the color of the beads. Like the beads used to be orange, and now they're blue. And so it's you know, but it's seamless. Like it works. Just
it makes
the
it
same.
Faster. Blue beads are faster.
They're cooler.
Nothing is as good as a blue bit.
Power.
Well, I think the oscillations of the light waves is faster, right? For blue.
Exactly. So technically, you get to see the result this much faster. Right. I like it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay, I think I'm getting close here. This is the last one. So this is a box. Okay, so the auction says box.
Oh, I saw this listing as well. Yeah,
boxed Apple II Plus, clean and working, and it is a buy it now of $850. It is, again, I'm not sure if we're supposed to like know this. But it's this is the person who made that iconic book. So it's it's basically photography of all of Apple's like stuff, hardware over the years. It's a really nice book. But anyway, I think now that the photographs are done,
this must have been in that book.
But anyway, so what this is, it's an Apple II Plus. It's in this Apple II Plus box. Looking at this box, it is not much of it's not much of anything. You know, it's a big white cardboard box that has red imprint, you know, Apple Fragile on it. I still look at this with a kind of nostalgia because I remember one of these in our basement, you know, you know, this is the box, you know? It's got the little markings on the side. It has the serial number on it and 16K memory size and the place where it was shipped to, which is the computer store, which presumably, and actually, if you look on the markings on the side of it, it's got, it's got sort of like stamped in stuff. And then there's a hand stamped plus on it, which tells you that this one had the Apple II Plus ROMs in it rather than having the Apple II ROMs in it, right? Because that's the only thing that distinguishes those two machines.
And written on it is 48K tested as well. It's interesting that it's the 16K model. Like, they seem to be more rare because who held on to the low-end models? Right. And so everyone that ever comes up seems to be the maxed out ones.
Yeah.
Wait,
everyone hung on to the 48K.
Say that again, Paul. I mean, the Apple II is labeled Apple II. The Apple II Plus is labeled Apple II Plus on the computer itself, right? On the case. So what are you saying? What does this plus tell us? Stamped on the box?
I guess it probably tells you that it had the 2 Plus lid, but it also had the 2 Plus ROMs.
Okay.
Because the outer box just says Apple.
Okay.
Yeah. So they have to stamp it and say, no, this is the plus one.
I see. Were they selling the two at the same time at any point?
Yep. Yeah. There was a time when you could choose either to get the non plus or the plus. So Integer Basic onboard or AppleSoft Basic onboard. And I guess the other difference was whether it would auto boot. So the Apple II Plus, if you turn it on, it will automatically start booting from the disk drive. Whereas the Apple II, if you turn it on, it just dumps you to the monitor and you have to like start the disk drive yourself. So anyway, so it's kind of cool to see like the little details on this box. I'll get back to that serial number in a second, but it starts with 1-4 and ends in 286. And if you sort of like page through and look at the bottom, I guess you can't see it at this size, but if you look at the serial number on the bottom of the machine, it is in fact the one that was on the box. It starts with 149, ends in 286. So this machine matches the box, which is cool. It has in it, you know, the manuals that came with it and the original discs and a little RF modulator and the foam. The foam looks nice. Looks like it's in fairly good condition. It's kind of neat to see how they were originally packaged, too. Mm-hmm. If you zoom in, there's a couple different places that tell you things about the Apple II motherboards. So in the upper left corner, there's a little white square where usually there's some kind of stamp that indicates sort of when the board was populated, basically. And in the very, very earliest ones, they were actual serial numbers. Like this was the 800th one made or whatever. But soon, like, you know, in 1978, I think, maybe even in 1977, they started putting date codes there. So you can read like the year and month of what was there. And this says 8517. So 8517 is a crazy date code. They stopped selling these in 1982.
Does that mean 1985?
Yeah. What this has to mean is that this was a very late replacement, like a really new board for this kind of you bring it in to get it replaced, you get it repaired, and they put in a new board. I mean, this has got to be about as late as they could possibly be. This has got to be about as young a board as you can possibly get on an Apple II Plus.
That is a really interesting thing to spot. Yeah. Nice.
So one thing that means is that the case matches the box, and it's really old. It's fairly old. But the motherboard inside is new. It was replaced at some point.
Right.
So immediately, you know, collectors go, bah, okay, this is not original. I don't want this. This is not cool. But
you might have the last Apple II board ever made.
Yeah, so that's the tension here. That's kind of an interesting board by itself, yeah. Unrelated to everything else, just because it's so late.
Mm-hmm. So, but I don't understand the 8517. So the 17 is what?
17? Oh, 17th week. So March.
Oh, okay.
Like
I'm like, it can't be day, and presumably a month. I know you guys aren't a metric, but how many months do you have in America? why can't you just go on a standard that the rest of us use? Okay, 17th week. Yeah. I will accept that.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that's interesting. That's interesting by itself. It might be interesting just to get this motherboard because it is so young. But the other thing that's interesting about this, let me go back to the, I don't know which is the right picture to go to.
There's more.
If we look at the number on the pan, right? So it says serial number 82S2149429 6. If you sort of mentally put in commas in that, you will realize that's like nearly 1.5 million.
Right.
They did not sell anywhere near that many of these. that is an insane serial number. Sometime many years ago, here we go. I went through like looking at a bunch of the labels that came on the bottom of these things. And so, and they really do kind of go in order. So you can sort of see as I'm scrolling through.
Yeah. But the ones you have are all in the thousands and tens of thousands, yeah. Not 1.5 million.
Right. So like, I think some of the later ones do end up being like 300,000, 542, 439. That I think is the last one that I found. The latest one that I found.
So what explains this crazy serial number then?
Well, so at the end of my this blog post, the last thing is, all this brings me to my oldest 2 Plus. What in the world is going on with this label? And the serial number is 1497165. So I have one of the oldest 2 Pluses that I have. I called it the Terrarium 2 Plus because it had a clear acrylic cover rather than a regular cover. It has the serial number that is, you know, it's like 1 million higher than any other that I have. And what's interesting is that a few of these others that I found in this kind of like crazy range, they're in the same spot. They're 1,049,000, you know, something. So I think I had some kind of conclusion, which is that I think, you know, I tried to do some detective work to figure out like where it fit. And my conclusion was that in fact, actually it's the 9, that was just stuck in there, you know, like I mean, possibly intentionally to make it look higher or whatever, but it fits between, it fits where 147165 would have in the sequence.
Oh, interesting.
So, and I think I've come across a couple others that have had these like 1.49 million serial numbers. And this is, you know, this is like the third or fourth one that I've seen that, you know, they're all right in that area.
So what's odd then, if it slots in there where it would really be like 144,286 in this case, but you've got other ones that are at 500,000.
Right, yes. Yeah,
so they started doing this and then they stopped doing
it? Yeah, it was like a very, very briefly, just in the 144s, they did this.
That is fascinating. Yeah, I want to find out the story behind that.
I would love to know.
That's awesome. That is really interesting.
So again, you know, again, I'm brought back to this question of like, this isn't original. It has this like weird Frankenstein, you know, like super new motherboard in it. But it also has this box, which is not only old and matches the pan, but also has this like really odd serial number.
That weird, which is on the box itself matching it. So, okay. So they also ship with that's weird and crazy.
So, I mean, none of this is actually really talked about in the auction. It just says, you know, nice clean Apple II Plus with original box and packaging, you know? Mm. But it is, it is kind of an interesting thing. It's being sold for buy it now of $850, which would be, you know, that is way up there, in terms of like what kind of price it would be, although you could make an offer. but right. But it has.
I think it's because the whole matching box thing. They're saying like here's a set, kind of making it more collectible because the box matches. Another idea is lots of times manufacturers will put out a weirdly modified serial number to indicate a set of things or whatever. So it could have been some particular distributor or whatever came on board at this time and they said, oh, we're going to separate. And the ones that go to that person are going to all have that 9 shoved in or whatever so they could tell that year which ones are going to wear.
Yeah, could be.
So I wonder if they all got sold through the same store or the same region or whatever. I found out that, oh, they're all from California. They're all from whatever.
Yeah, the shipping label says this went to the computer store in Santa Monica from the Southwest Regional Support Center in Irvine, California. So it's conceivable, actually, that all of the 1.49 millions are from Southwest Regional or even from the computer store.
Or if around the time that this was sold, if they had a new processing thing. So sometimes people are like, uh-oh, both of these are going to be stamping out serial numbers and we're going to end up with overlap or whatever. Stick an extra digit on that one. And so you could maybe there's – this one was 1494286 and there's another one sold in Detroit that was just 1-4-4-2-8-6. And they solved it with a kludge.
Could be. I would love
to
know.
It's all interesting.
Like somebody out there knew the story.
I would love to know as well. That's so much more interesting than I would have thought this auction could be. That's fascinating.
Anyway.
Well done, Paul. Yeah. Nicely spotted.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. So then, in fact, we've made it to the end of the eBay auctions and we can move on to closing discussions. Carrington, you have...
Or as we call it, hour three.
That's right. Blake has written nothing, although it was alphabetically first. But Blake, do you have any closing thoughts?
I, again, do not have any specific premeditated closing thoughts.
But here's another hour on the arm transition.
we could talk about that arm transition. I'm looking forward to getting that first arm Mac laptop. Maybe I'll let my daughter help me set that up. But I keep saying that every time, like the past several episodes, which has ranged over, you know, a few months, that I want to eventually get my HP 1100LX figured out, and I haven't. I need to figure out why it won't read a very small capacity CF card so that I can start running important DOS applications in my pocket on my commute. Oh, I don't commute anywhere. So
so they have to run very quickly because they have to be up and running and then finished by the walk over to the next room.
That's right. When I walk up to make my sandwich or when I walk downstairs from the bedroom. So I'll give an update on that. But that's about it. Everything's
all right. Carrington, you have put something here.
Have I?
Escape Games.
Oh, yes. Escape Games is the new Parsley Games. So do you guys know what Parsley Games are?
I have experienced one once.
Don't think so.
Okay, yeah. So they are kind of like a Choose Your Own Adventure game where one person acts as the computer or the host, and then other people, it could be a massive crowd of people, are playing the adventure. So they will either take turns or as a group say, go west, pick up this, kill the dragon with the sword or whatever. And so it's just a way to play those games. The Parsley Games are kind of a spoken version of those. Well, anyway, a group of friends of mine, we call ourselves Mary's Boyfriend. So we're a group of pals and we play a lot of escape games. We love escape games. And as a group, they always want team names and our team name is Mary's Boyfriend because one time we played a very large escape room. It was a huge group of people and it was mostly people we know. And then a couple of others had shown up as well, including a girl named Mary who was waiting for her boyfriend to finally show up. And when he finally showed up, we were razzing them. And then when they asked for team name, we're like, oh, we're totally Mary's Boyfriend. And for years now, our group, I have no idea who those people are, but we're still named after her boyfriend, whatever his name was. So because escape rooms are closed, because, you know, if you do one, you'll get COVID and die. We've found a lot of escape rooms now have gone online. It's a virtual thing, which is super fun. And so we, instead of doing a local one, we found one, I think it was in Calgary. And so you go in, and I thought it was going to be like a person at the escape room would be going through the escape room and you'd be on Zoom telling them what to do. But instead it's like, basically a Parsley game. They've turned escape rooms into those, and escape room staff gets on Zoom with you and describes it and has pictures and walks through, and you tell them to try it. And it was super, super fun. So if you, like me, miss escape rooms, then you should know that many of them are online. And I think next what we're going to do is in Tokyo or something. So it's a way to play escape rooms around the world you wouldn't get to.
Nice. That's
cool.
Interesting, yeah.
It was super, super, super fun. So I'm glad that they are back in my life. I love that kind of group puzzle adventure stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, I did one.
Not retro computing, but it's what I did. Just one?
I've done one. It didn't sound that fun, but I was actually quite. I really liked it a lot. Actually, once doing it, so
I dug it a lot. I got hooked from my first one.
Yeah.
Nice.
I love them.
There was they redid a mall near us in Arlington, and into a new modern space, and they have an escape room, and my wife and daughter and I did it. I had never done one before. It was just like 9 months ago, and it was quite fun, actually. It was in fact, I think we would have done one again if it had not been for recent turns of events. But hey, now I can, do that. My daughter might want to wait. So we have the ARM-based Mac before we go online and do it.
Much easier.
But, we'll see. To do with ARM-based Mac. We'll, it'll come soon. It'll come soon. So, yeah.
Oh, and Greg in the comments is asking if they used VR gear. Nope. It was basically just a person talking and had a map of the escape room and on a computer, and then just would release photos of rooms as we entered things. It's okay. You found a box, and here's what it looks like, and here's the symbols on the side, and then just acted as the guide. And we'd say, well, we tried this. It goes, oh, well, you try to do that, and then this happens. And it just acting as a text parser. It was Parsley games, and this are basically like playing old Zork and games, text adventure games, where a person is acting as the computer parser.
That sounds quite cool.
It was super fun. So we really liked it a lot. Anyway, that's it. Not retro computing based, except kind of in the Zork way. But that's really the only social thing I've done in ages.
Nice. Yeah. I hear you.
What about you, Paul? What's new in Paul land?
I have. I've been occasionally doing little bits of editing, which hasn't happened very frequently. But we're closing in on when Virtual Kansas Fest 2020 is, I think since we recorded last, we have opened up the Discord server. And so that's...
Which I've got to get around to joining. I've yet to do
that. Yeah. That's basically the communications medium that we're using. Discord is... And Blake has his sticker. Or maybe it's his pin. I don't know. So the Discord is basically just like... It's a chat room. It was, I think, originally designed as kind of like gamer communication, you know? But it's a lot like Slack, actually, if you're used to Slack. But anyway, so, we've got 150 people or something already in there, and many channels and much activity and much cat herding and stuff.
no doubt.
But it's pretty neat, actually. But I feel like I've spent a fair amount of time recently just kind of like sort of responding to suggestions and telling people, how about maybe discuss this in the channel devoted to it rather than here and that kind of stuff.
So this is a public, I'm sure it's mentioned on the website. I didn't realize there was a Discord server for that. It's public. I mean, it's for non-presenters, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, actually that might be one advantage of my, mentioning it here. This gets edited and out in time, but, so in the, access to the Discord server is basically what registration gets you. That's like where the community is. You also have, the actual sort of sessions are going to be taking place in Zoom. But Discord is where all the sort of like offline conversation and stuff goes. And actually Discord does have sort of like video chat as well.
Yeah. So I'm curious just for those, I'm one of those who didn't catch it, I guess, on the first take, but yeah, I joined, but where would I find, obviously we're not going to, where would I find having registered the Discord link? Is it in an email or?
I think it's, the email probably links to a sort of like, thanks for registering page on kansasfest.org that has all the links and stuff on it. And also there's a little YouTube intro movie. If you don't know Discord already, this is kind of what it's like, what to expect and that kind of stuff. And the other thing I would say is that when you first get there, if you get there and you think, well, this isn't very exciting, there's exactly one channel and exactly one message. Don't then leave without reading that one message, because that one message says, click here to get to the rest of the channels.
Okay.
So we've had a few people who have not read that one message.
Okay.
The clicking here thing says, I agree to the code of conduct, basically.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, I'll look at my, I'll look at, so the link is somewhere. The actual Discord link is for the server itself is.
Yeah. It's not entirely public because the plan is you register and you get that link.
Yeah.
But if you can't find it, then you can email someone at Kansas Post.
Yeah, I think it said if you register, you get an email.
Okay, I'll look at the email.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, I get 900 emails a day, sadly, which are not emails, but just junk. And so I miss everything.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have gotten into that habit as well. Like I'm subscribed to the CC Talk mailing list. And so I have a sort of a habit of I'll see that something has come in on that mailing list and I will file it in my vintage folder. And I might read the subject line. And
yeah,
I might.
I'm the same way. So many feeds. Yeah.
So I think when I retire, you know, I will have many messages to read, to kick back by the fire and read from 2020's CC Talk mailing list.
In that future time, we've got all the spare time in your hands in the future.
But anyway, so yeah, I'm looking quite forward to this whole virtual Kansas Fest thing, but it's already occupying a fair amount of time, which is not exactly what I'd hoped for, but it's still the enthusiasm is great. And Hackfest actually starts. The Hackfest is the programming contest that, in normal years, you basically just put something together in the week that you're there. You know, so the fun part is the kind of constrained time. Like, what can you do in this little bit of time? Because this time it's so little time, Hackfest actually starts in advance and ends in advance. So I think we're something like 5 days away from the beginning of Hackfest, and then it ends like the day before. Be aware of that too, if you are interested in doing Hackfest.
And be aware that I think I'm one of the judges this year.
Oh, are you? Oh, yeah, I think you are.
Judge you all harshly. Okay. Yeah. So. As a former winner of Hackfest,
yeah.
I'd just like to point out I'm going to judge you all very harshly.
That's right. Anyway, that's what has been occupying my time and will, but I think that's it. So I look forward to turning the fans back on in this room.
Awesome.
Anyway, so that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfid.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time,
Retro Compute on ARM processors.
Yes.